This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
But the problem is that a lot of that meaningful protest is going to be captured or kidnapped by the engineered protests, which are funded by major foundations via NGOs. In essence, you're going to have a situation where the engineered protests will override any meaningful grassroots protest movement. The anti-war movement is virtually non-existent. But at the same time, the engineered protests will seek to delegitimize the president in a way which has never been witnessed in U.S. history.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Michelle Chosadovsky. Today's show, will the Trump presidency prevail? Michelle Chosadovsky is an economist and the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. He is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Today we'll discuss Michelle's latest articles, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Campaign to Destabilize the Trump Presidency, and Color Revolution Against Donald Trump. Michelle Chosadovsky, welcome.
Delighted to be on the program.
In our last interview, Political Crisis in the United States, recorded before the U.S. presidential election, you predicted that regardless of who won the election, be it Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, that the new U.S. administration would be a dysfunctional one that might lead eventually to a situation of martial law. Do you think that events are playing out the way you thought they might?
Well, in some regards they are, because Donald Trump has started his first days in office, and the major conflicts which existed both prior to the elections as well as after the elections are still there. He's clashing with the intelligence community. He is the target of media smears, which are ongoing, particularly by CNN, but with other mainstream media. And I should recall that CNN, just the day before his inauguration, I think it was 2 days before, had actually envisaged a disaster scenario in which the elected president would be assassinated. In other words, it was a terror event which was part of a special CNN program. And in fact, the subtitles were incredible, because they said, "Who is designated survivor at the inauguration? Disaster could put Obama cabinet member in the Oval Office." And they had built the scenario of assassination of the president, the vice president, members of Congress. Now, from my standpoint, that was not sloppy journalism. That was an act of propaganda directed against the elected president. But I noticed that in the immediate wake of his inauguration, the campaign by the media has gone into full blast. I mean, they haven't sort of gone back to normalcy where they're looking at the president, they're criticizing him. No, they continue in the smear operation. Now, is it dysfunctional or not to have a president who wants to normalize relations with Russia? Is it dysfunctional to have a president who has differences with the intelligence community, who is ultimately going to have to operate in tandem with these agencies. Some people call that the deep state, namely the CIA, Wall Street, the oil conglomerates pull the strings. But at the same time, within his administration, you have people who are firmly committed to waging war. His appointee to the Pentagon with Mattis, the mad dog, and then Tillerson in the State Department. But on the other hand, this president is elected and starts his mandate under circumstances which are exceptional, namely a mass campaign against him with the possibility of an impeachment, with various actions against him. And these actions are not necessarily motivated from the grassroots of society. They're from a competing faction associated with Hillary Clinton, but it's a competing neoconservative faction. And I think essentially the issue is foreign policy. It's the conduct of foreign policy. It has to do with relations with Moscow. It has to do with the war in the Middle East. It has to do with China. In some cases, they coincide with, you know, Trump coincides with the neocons, and in others, he doesn't. And so we're dealing with very significant clashes within the establishment. And Trump doesn't quite conform to the dominant neoconservative perspective, which ultimately is also very much tied into U.S. intelligence.
You write that what is at stake are fundamental rivalries within the U.S. establishment, marked by the clash between competing corporate factions, each of which is intent upon exerting control over the incoming U.S. presidency, which you've pretty much just explained. How would you describe these two competing corporate factions in terms of foreign policy?
Well, first of all, we should understand that competition within the establishment is ongoing. It's not normally covered by the media, but the banks are at each other's throats. We know that. They're competing, they're expanding their clutch and so on. So that there are conflicts within Wall Street, there are conflicts in virtually every sector of the corporate world, so to speak, and both within the United States and also internationally. And those conflicts are more or less innate to the capitalist world order, and they've been the object of a lot of scholarly analysis, and people don't seem to realize that. There may be a Washington consensus on certain things. They'll say, well, Washington consensus on IMF reforms, but ultimately, who is going to pick up the pieces when there, you know, when there are bankruptcies, when there's destabilization, when there's a recession or a crash of financial markets? And it's also the fact that all this is very much manipulated. We know that these financial institutions can manipulate markets, and ultimately they manipulate markets not only to appropriate the wealth of the millions of people who invested in the stock market, but also they direct this against their competitors, and we saw that in 2008 when the stock market collapsed, and General Motors was the object of major attacks by particular financial institutions. So that is part of the way that capitalism functions. Now, within that structure, there are what I would call cross-cutting alliances, which are very complex. They're cross-cutting alliances within the corporate establishment, and they're also cross-cutting alliances in the sphere of foreign policy. And we see that emerging, where the Russians are now in alliance with the Turks, with Turkey. They have an alliance with China, and within the realm of foreign policy, there are certain things which are happening, which in a a sense, are upsetting the monolithic foreign policy stance which unfolded during the Obama administration, and which also led to a number of new conflicts and wars, namely Syria, the Ukraine, Yemen, and of course the confrontation with China. And I can see that that in effect what is now occurring are certain shifts in those alliances. We can look back in history to World War One, how shifting alliances occurred and ultimately were conducive to World War One, the Triple Alliance and the Triple Entente. And here you have, I think in most recent developments, the fact that Turkey is now, which is a NATO member state, is actually working hand in glove with Moscow. And also, Moscow, of course, is supporting the government in Damascus. And there's a campaign against the Islamic State, a military campaign. And we know that the Islamic State is supported by the United States. So, again, cross-cutting alliances. Turkey is a member of NATO, but at the same time, it's working with the Russians. So that, in a sense, the foreign policy, the monolithic foreign policy agenda of the neocons is under threat. And then, of course, you have the emergence of Trump, who, through his narrative, might, in fact, lead to the normalization of relations with Moscow. And that's something I think they do not want. It doesn't necessarily mean that a Trump administration would be less inclined to wage war or regime change than the previous administration.
Well, if Trump wants to normalize relations with Russia, which is what he said during his campaign, then there must be a very powerful faction behind this attempted shift in foreign policy, don't you think?
Well, absolutely, because normalizing with Russia has very broad implications. It means it means possibly a solution to the situation in Ukraine, you know, where they will accept, in fact, a situation which is already de facto the existence of a Donbass Novorossiya political formation, which would emerge as a new country and which would be recognized. I think inevitably that is something which would have to be negotiated. It would also have a bearing on the war in Syria, as to whether, you know, they continue supporting the terrorists. I'm talking about Washington. Washington supports the terrorists. Everybody knows that Al-Qaeda and ISIS are intelligence assets. And they're used as foot soldiers of the Western military alliance, supported by Saudi Arabia, etc. Now, is that option going to crumble, or is it going to continue? And that has a lot to do with Russia-U.S. relations.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Will the Trump Presidency Prevail? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. In your article, Color Revolution Against Donald Trump, you write that protest movements are envisaged alongside a campaign to disrupt. What is the hashtag DisruptJ20 campaign?
Well, I think that campaign ultimately didn't really reach its objective. It was a campaign to disrupt inauguration, and we saw some events on January 20th occurring, but they weren't of much significance, and they certainly didn't really threaten the process of inauguration as they had initially set out. And my understanding is that the disrupt process will be ongoing. I don't think that the objective was really to disrupt the inauguration per se. We saw in the march, which occurred on the 21st of January, one day after the inauguration, that was of course much more significant. And those who had planned and engineered these protest movements were not intent on actually unseating Trump or creating problems at the inauguration itself. But they create conditions which are intent on disrupting the functioning of the Trump administration in one form or another. And those protest movements were essentially focusing on women's rights. They weren't geared towards anything else, anti-war and so on and so forth. And one thing which was quite revealing is that they were taking place not only in the United States, but in a number of other countries. And it raises the question, why on earth would people in other countries protest against the head of state in the United States of America rather than protesting their own governments? And there, that provides, in a sense, the notion that protest movements internationally are recognizing that the U.S. presidency is some form of global governance. But it's also to delegitimize the U.S. presidency internationally, not only in the United States, but around the world, and using symbols and so on and so forth. Those marches of January 21st are of the nature of a kind of revolution, in the sense that they are they're supported by donor organizations. They are engineered. They're very carefully put together, and they're intended to question the legitimacy of the U.S. President, rather than focus on important issues such as the wars in the Middle East, civil rights, the broader issue of civil rights in the United States, and so on and so forth.
Well, you write that the objective of the engineered protests, which has the support of U.S. intelligence, is to undermine the legitimacy of the Trump presidency, which you've just said. What is the point of rendering the Trump presidency illegitimate?
Well, that's a very important question, because it is right at the beginning of his mandate. It suggests, in effect, a regime change scenario. Now, if we go back to the period between November 8th and January 20th, we see the emergence of a number of initiatives. One of the initiatives is an impeachment agenda. That impeachment agenda has already been launched. Well, it hasn't been legally launched, but it was the object of a petition. There were members of Congress that actually said, yes, we're going to impeach him. Then, of course, there was the campaign portraying the president as an agent of Moscow. That hasn't disappeared. Okay, he's still an agent of Moscow from the perspective, let's say, of CNN. Okay. So the issue of legitimacy of the presidency, I think it has been accepted by the majority of the American people. But it has not been accepted by the power brokers behind, those who were behind Hillary Clinton and those who waged the media's campaign, because they're still at it. They still are presenting him as a Manchurian candidate. And they are also questioning his legitimacy. So there's a smear campaign which is ongoing. There's possibility of impeachment, although I think it's pretty unlikely that would actually succeed, because still Trump has the Republicans control both the Senate and the House. So the likelihood of an impeachment going ahead in the foreseeable future, I think that's pretty unlikely, but it's there. Those initiatives are being debated. They're talking points. And I don't think it's simply going to go away. And then there's another aspect. Trump, of course, it will be the object of grassroots protests. No question about it, because his policies are outright perspective. There's going to be protest, meaningful protest. But the problem is that a lot of that meaningful protest is going to be captured or kidnapped by the engineered protests, which are funded by major foundations and so on via NGOs. In essence, you're going to have a situation where the engineered protests will override any meaningful grassroots protest movement in the United States, whether it's from African Americans or from Latinos or people broadly in the area of civil rights, anti-war movement, and so on and so forth. The anti-war movement is virtually non-existent. But at the same time, the engineered protests will seek to delegitimize the president in a way which has never been witnessed in U.S. history. I mean, every single president that comes in is the object of protest. We know that. But at the same time, the president is also the object of support. And now we see something which is very pernicious. I'm not saying this, I don't want to sound apologetic for Trump, because I think that the protest against his administration is needed and is justified, but the people who are preventing this from occurring are precisely the so-called left progressives, which are funded by tax-free foundations and which are waging these engineered protests with the view eventually to leading to something else, which could be a regime change. And some people have even intimated that he wouldn't finish his 4 years in office.
I watched the video, The Revolution Business, which you have posted as part of your article, Color Revolution Against Donald Trump. What about a color revolution here in the United States? When Hillary Clinton gave her concession speech, both she and Bill Clinton were wearing purple. And it was very striking. I noticed it immediately. It was obviously planned.
Looked at that, that Hillary Clinton was wearing purple clothing and so on. I think that campaign is most probably going to reemerge, but not necessarily now. It might take place a little bit later. But there's certainly the symbols of the color revolution made in America are there. And I should mention that those organizations which have supported color revolutions in different parts of the world are the same organizations which are now involved in protesting against Trump. And I think it's important to look a little bit at the history of color revolutions. Color revolutions started in the 90s. With regime change in Yugoslavia. And it's worth noting that one of the main actors of this color revolution, which was supported by the CIA, was against President Milosevic. But then they formed, that was OTPOR. OTPOR was an organization which was opposed to Milosevic, which led to his downfall. And OTPOR subsequently established a training strategizing outfit entitled the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies. And it became some kind of a consulting outfit specializing revolution on contract to the CIA. And then CANVAS was involved in the Arab Spring, in 2011 in Egypt in particular. and it has also been advising and training U.S.-sponsored opposition groups in a large number of countries. So that there is definitely, there is a revolution business. There is a color revolution which is funded dissent, manufactured dissent, where foundations will go. You have the National Endowment for Democracy, Freedom House, and I should mention there are other foundations. Well, of course, the Open Society Institute, but there are also foundations in Western Europe. There's the Hans Seidel Foundation, which is linked to the right wing of the Christian Democratic Party in Germany, and that foundation has been involved in Venezuela, in Ukraine, and it is also now in Cuba. It has links to Cuban NGOs and Cuban, you know, research institutes and so on. So that funding dissent is something which is really entrenched in the New World Order. The World Social Forum 2001 was funded by the Ford Foundation. So that is the sort of international arm of protest. And they meet in various locations. They bring together a whole bunch of NGOs. Many of those NGOs are then funded individually by various foundations. So in a sense, Wall Street has captured the protest movements and co-opted them. This whole process is certainly very relevant to what is happening in the United States. I should say the Occupy Wall Street movement, which was also involved in the protest against Trump and during the inauguration, well, they're also, in a sense, funded by foundations. Well, it's all done indirectly, but you can say that the Ford Foundation, Gates Foundation, as well as other foundations are behind the Occupy Wall Street, done via the Tides Foundation. Initially, it was launched by Adbusters. But again, there are always intermediaries in this process. And I think really what is important there is that we really don't have an opposition. We don't have a grassroots opposition where people join hands and say, well, no, we don't want this kind of government. We don't have that. And everything is segmented. You'll have the anti-war movements. You'll have the movement against neoliberal economic reforms. Then you have the women's rights movements. And they're all segmented. They don't talk to one another. The Women's March on January 21st was largely focusing on women's rights and directed against Donald Trump. But there was nothing on the war in Iraq. There's nothing on the war in Syria. There's nothing on the war in Yemen. And then maybe token reference to the rights of African Americans and the situation in Detroit and so on. That doesn't necessarily come up. It becomes very stylized. And I think essentially if we want to really build a resistance the U.S. administration, we have to break down these whole structures of funded and manufactured dissent, which are really entrenched. I know from my own experience with the World Social Forum, well, there's some very good people in there, they're good NGOs, but they tacitly accept that they're funded by the Ford Foundation. There was one group within the World Social Forum which protested, that was when they were in Mumbai, and said, no, we can't wage a campaign against global capitalism and the neoliberal agenda, and ask them to fund our expenses. And then the Ford Foundation actually withdrew. But there were other donors that then came in. And at one point, they were even funded by the Ministry of Overseas Development of the Tony Blair government. Okay? So funding dissent is a very convenient process because then it leads to this engineered type of movement, which then forecloses the possibility of real mass movements.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Will the Trump presidency prevail? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, speaking of engineered mass movements, let's talk about what you have pointed out went global, the Women's March, the day after the inauguration of Donald Trump. Coincidentally, I had just watched a film. It was called Pussy Riot, A Punk Prayer, produced by HBO, of events taking place in February 2012 in Moscow. And, of course, this is a female punk rock band that was staging protests against the Russian Orthodox Church and Vladimir Putin specifically. There was no mention in this film of any organizations behind these protests. I did notice, though, during the trial, one of the women was wearing a T-shirt emblazoned with the upright clenched fist, which is an emblem of Otpor, which you just mentioned, the Serbian NGO that played a key role in the overthrow of Slobodan Milosevic. Then we have the massive Women's March on the 21st. I was seeing emails and Twitter feeds in the weeks or days leading up to it telling women to knit pussy hats. And then I saw pictures online of plastic garbage bags full of these pink knitted hats that they were handing out to people. And I thought to myself, this is too much of a coincidence. Pussy hats, pussy rioters, and of course, like I said, they had that emblem of the clenched fist. That's also on the Occupy poster that you posted, right?
Absolutely. I mean, really, we are in a sort of a copy and paste situation where I don't know who is behind the pussy riots, but I suspect the clenched fist started in Yugoslavia in 1999. 2000, and then we find it in various national events in different countries, and then it lands up in the Arab Spring, then it lands up in Occupy, so that the clenched fist becomes a symbol of various organizations in different countries, and the reason is that they're supported by the same NGOs, and those NGOs are supported by the same foundations. And so that it becomes a logo. It's a bit like Osama bin Laden. You know, you'll find his face everywhere where the CIA has some kind of subsidiary al-Qaeda affiliated group. Okay, they'll have their symbols, and what it reflects is the fact that these foundations and NGOs, they operate internationally, and they use the same symbols and they copy one another. And as I mentioned, there's an Otpor canvas CIA model, okay? Otpor being the organization which then founded Canvas. And then Canvas, of course, is involved in training, is involved in public relations, and so on. So I think we can understand that the clenched fist symbol, which prevails ultimately in all these various locations, it really is the product of a global agenda, which oversees protest movements in different parts of the world.
The women's marches that went global on the 21st of January, the day after Donald Trump's inauguration, this kind of a massive demonstrations, these things have to be planned way in advance, don't they?
I would suspect, first of all, if you want to plan a march which is carried in a large number of countries simultaneously, you have to have a big organizational structure of partners, you know, partner organizations which work together, which coordinate when it's going to take place and so on and so forth. I would say, yes, it requires a lot of money as well. You have to organize these things. Of course, you're not necessarily paying the protesters, although some of them might be paid, but you have to have organizational skills, you have to have communication. It just doesn't emerge like that, that on the same day, different parts of the world, you come up with a mass movement with similar concepts. And ironically, what struck me is the fact that this mass movement in different parts of the world is directed against the U.S. president and not against the local prime minister or head of state. Okay, if it occurs in France or in Germany and so on. And I mean, it's also occurred in Asia, in Japan, in the Philippines.
Let's talk about this new concept of fake news. Now, this meme of fake news, this was rolled out as an attack on the alternative media, but it looks like it's been turned around and it's being used on the mainstream media. I mean, there is Donald Trump in his first press conference, before he was sworn in, actually, refusing to take a question from CNN and accusing them of being fake news. I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, the initial campaign, of course, was launched by the mainstream media. I mean, it was the Washington Post that started up the campaign against fake news, and which was essentially directed against the independent and alternative media, mainly the online media. So we were the targets. And then, of course, the independent media responded to that, particularly with regard, let's say, to the war in Syria, for instance, where they showed, in effect, that the mainstream media was involved in fake news. They accused the independent media of being fake. They had more than 200 alternative media, which are listed by a website called Propaganda or Not, Prop or Not. And then the Washington Post covers that, and then it becomes, of course, an object of debate. And the backlash from the independent media is to say, well, prove it. I mean, CNN is involved in persistent manipulation of images and concepts. I've been following them for quite a number of years, and I recall that when they were covering the protest movement and riots in Tibet, they switched the images and took the protest movements were taking place in India. Okay, they switched the countries. When the BBC was covering the so-called liberation of Tripoli by, in fact, they were Al-Qaeda freedom fighters, they showed images of celebration on Green Square in Tripoli, and what we saw were people waving Indian flags. They had taken footage from another country and they slashed it in. We've got many, many cases of fake images, manipulated concepts and so on. And of course, the alternative media responded to that. And there's a truth movement within the alternative media. Well, there's also alternative media which may be funded by corporations. That's another matter. So that the fake news thing, in a sense, backlashed on the mainstream media. And of course, and also Trump, because the mainstay of that fake news was also to depict Trump as an agent of Moscow and to accuse Moscow of hacking the Democratic National Committee, that this, of course, then became viral and it ultimately backlashed on the Washington Post, the New York Times, and CNN. But battle is certainly not over. And what is at stake at the moment, pretty complex, is that most of the corporate media are intent upon continuing this campaign against Trump, of smearing him, both in his personal life as well as in his politics. But then, on the other hand, you have some sections of the media, largely those associated with Rupert Murdoch, namely the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, and Fox News, they tend to be pro-Trump, so that we have really a battle between competing media conglomerates.
Well, and as well, the mainstream media has admittedly been infiltrated by the CIA for many, many decades, right?
Well, of course, that's well documented, Operation Mockingbird and so on. We know that the major news feeders, okay, both print as well as network television, as well as online, New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, the Time Warner conglomerates, they have historical links with U.S. intelligence, and they have embedded reporters which are linked to U.S. intelligence. This is known and documented, and it should not come as any surprise that they would act in a way which is consistent with interests emanating from the intelligence community. Now, the question is, will Trump come to terms with the intelligence community on key issues? And those key issues, that I think there are two, as far as foreign policy is concerned. One has to do with the war on terrorism, which is the mainstay of U.S. intelligence, namely to use al-Qaeda-affiliated entities, which they themselves created as foot soldiers and as mechanisms and as tools of conquest, ultimately. Destabilize countries, send in the Islamic terrorists, and destroy the country and pick up the pieces. That's one. I'm simplifying, but, al-Qaeda is a creation of the CIA. Osama bin Laden was recruited by the CIA. Now, that legend has to prevail, and that instrument of intervention has to prevail, and they're going to hang on to it. Now, is Trump going to question that legitimacy? I doubt it. But there may be areas in which there could be disagreements.
I'm speaking with economist and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show, Will the Trump Presidency Prevail? I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
The other one has to do with U.S.-Russia relations. And it also has to do with U.S.-China relations. And there are different possible perspectives there. China is still a major trading partner of the United States of America. And without China, there's no consumer economy. Everything we buy is made in China. So there are different perspectives, and one has to be very careful how you handle that, because it has a very significant impact on everything which happens in the United States. We consume on a day-to-day basis goods made in China. Now, we don't want to disrupt that. And then there's another aspect which economists barely mention, is that when you import goods from China, the GDP goes up in the United States. Because why? Let's say you import shirts from China at $36 a dozen and you resell them at $36 a unit. And what happens is this adds to the GDP, is called value added, because the revenues generated are generated at the level of distribution, retail, and so on. And that is something, when people talk about economic growth in the United States, they have to understand that a large part of that economic growth is not based on production in the United States, but on imports. And it's called import-led development. Now, of course, that is also something which is crucial to the Trump narrative, because he has pointed to the fact that industry is offshored, and then he's blaming China for that. He shouldn't be blaming China, because it's the corporations which are sending the jobs overseas. It's not China which is taking the initiative.
Well, Trump has been, and some of his appointees have been, attacking China. That's a bit dangerous.
Well, it's very dangerous, because it will contribute to solidifying relations with Russia. But it also has very significant economic implications. Now, from my experience, I've visited China frequently the last few years, is that in the business community, the academic community, they tend to be very pro-American. If you talk to scholars at the Academy of Sciences or you go to the Shanghai stock market, everybody is pro-American and they value trade and so on and so forth. But it's at the level of the political establishment, the military, where you have a certain reticence. But again, it's a very contradictory relationship that the West has with China. It's also, by its nature, it's cross-cutting alliances. You have an alliance with China in the area of trade and economic cooperation, bilateral trade. And then on the other hand, you have conflicts in the arena of geopolitics. And so, again, it's a very complex relationship, but it's also potentially very dangerous because Lord China and Russia, of course, nuclear powers, and so is the United States, and any kind of military conflict between superpowers would lead to the possibility of a global conflict.
Now, Michelle, have you described, it seems to me that you have described the Chinese economy as dollarized. Is that true? And if so, what does that mean?
I wouldn't say that the Chinese economy is dollarized in the sense that now it's pushing for its own monetary system and it's protecting it. It doesn't have the same mechanisms which other Southeast Asian countries may have. I would say, let's say, the Mexican monetary system is dollarized, okay? Even Brazilian monetary system is dollarized because they have a link up to the U.S. dollar. I think that China now is moving away from this dollarized monetary system, linking up to gold, with also instruments of control of foreign exchange markets.
Now, you mentioned two things that were going to be very fundamental with regard to the Trump administration, the policy on the war on terror, and secondly, the foreign policy in general. Now, right after 9/11, the two things that happened, of course, we went to war with foreign countries, but also the Patriot Act was passed, which has led to basically a police state here in the United States. Now, assuming Trump's arguments with the intelligence agencies are real, do you see any difference emerging within the Trump administration, for instance, with regard to Homeland Security?
Well, this is a very important question. I asked myself that question when I heard his speech, because President Trump has committed himself to eliminating terrorism from the face of the earth. You recall it. He said, textually, we will reinforce old alliances and form new ones and unite the civilized world against radical Islamic terrorism, which we will eradicate from the face of the earth. Those were his words. Now, those words are not really that different from George W. Bush's historic speech at the U.S. Congress on September 20th, 2001. We remember that because that's when he says, you're either with us or with the terrorists, if I recall his presentation. In other words, Trump is using even the same concepts because he says the civilized world, see, in relation to his predecessors, namely Bush and Obama. And his statement regarding Islamic terrorism bears a canny resemblance to the worded script of George W. Bush in the wake of 9/11. You're either with us or with the terrorists. From this day forward, any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as hostile regime. Those were his words. Now, the question is, Trump has expressed some skepticism with regard to 9/11. And he has also said that he wants to open up a new 9/11 inquiry. Now, this may occur, but it may not lead to any departure in terms of the global war on terrorism doctrine. But it's very important, however, to understand that that global war on terrorism doctrine is not only part of U.S. foreign policy. It is also embedded in U.S. military doctrine. It's also part of the training manuals. It's also part of the indoctrination of the armed forces. Because when people are recruited into the armed forces, the first thing they're told is said, we're fighting a global war on terrorism, which gives them the idea that they're doing something useful for the homeland, okay? And we're not going to say, well, we're going to invade Syria and Iraq and knock the hell out of and kill people there. No, you say we're going to go after the terrorists. And the heads of state, heads of government will say the same. And in some regards, they believe their own propaganda. When Obama says we're going to go after them, of course, they go after the Islamic State in northern Syria and in Iraq, but we know very well that the Islamic State is a construct which is protected by the United States and its allies. Now, how far will Trump go into questioning the contradictions surrounding America's war on terrorism? And I think that's a very important question. Will Trump endorse the neocon consensus and join what Bush and Obama have stated previously, namely, we have to go after the terrorists, etc., etc.? Or will he recognize that the war on terrorism is fake and it's essentially a campaign, a crusade which justifies a global war of conquest, a hegemonic project? Or will he wage what we might describe as a real war on terrorism by confronting the military and intelligence apparatus which covertly support the Islamic terrorists? And that includes U.S. intelligence, the Pentagon, of course NATO as well, which was involved in recruiting the terrorists in Syria right from day one. It includes Britain, MI6, Israel's Mossad, and so on. So will Trump actually question that consensus? If he does, he's out. He won't be able to sustain it. It's very much entrenched in U.S. military doctrine. And I suspect he might, he's committed to going after the terrorists, but he's certainly not committed in going after the CIA, which supports the terrorists. That's what I'm really suggesting, because lest we forget, Al-Qaeda is a creation of the CIA going back to the Soviet-Afghan war. And if he chooses to question the fact that Al-Qaeda is a U.S. Intelligence asset, that means he's at war with the intelligence community.
Well, yeah. He has said he wants to join with Russia and wipe out ISIS.
Well, you see, I think he believes official propaganda. He doesn't realize that Al-Qaeda is supported by the CIA. That's very frequent, that politicians will sort of come to the acceptance that the terrorists are an outside force, that they are threatening America, and they will believe their own propaganda. I think he believes his own propaganda. He's not going to budge on that, but the problem is if the Russians are going after the terrorists, which in fact happen to be CIA-supported, and you join the Russians in doing that, well, then you're in a big mess. But maybe the answer to that is that there may be some shift in how those terrorists will be deployed in future war theaters. But the stakes are very, very significant, because we have Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations in some 40, 50 countries. Well, I haven't counted them, but most of the Muslim world, you have Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations, but you have them in the Russian Federation, you have them in India, you have them in Pakistan, you have them in Thailand, you have them in Malaysia, Indonesia, Nigeria with Boko Haram, most of the Maghreb. And so if those Al-Qaeda-affiliated organizations are viewed for what they are, instruments of conquest, well, he will have to accept that that strategy prevails. That strategy was established by Brzezinski during the Carter administration, and then it's spread to other countries. And I don't think that Trump is going to intervene in that regard, because that would literally upset the whole structure of U.S. intelligence. And I think that U.S. intelligence prevails over the President of the United States.
Michel Chosadovsky, thank you very much.
Well, it's delighted to be again on Guns and Butter, which is a very important program in the independent media.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Michel Chosadovsky. Today's show has been Will the Trump Presidency Prevail? Michel Chosadovsky is the founder, director, and editor of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal, Quebec. The Global Research website, globalresearch.ca, publishes news articles, commentary, background research, and analysis. Michel Chosadovsky is the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty and the New World Order, War and Globalization, The Truth Behind September 11th, America's War on Terrorism, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity, as well as co-editor of the anthology The Global Economic Crisis, The Great Depression of the 21st Century. All books are available at globalresearch.ca. That's globalresearch.ca. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at G&B Radio.
Hey, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Hello.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, climate scientist James G. Anderson returns with a clear, cogent, and even mildly optimistic discussion of climate change. Plus, we'll hear from Michael Parenti and David Rovics. I hope you'll stay tuned. Harvard climate scientist James G. Anderson returns this week, or rather, we return to a very nice interview with Anderson. Last week we heard the first part of the interview. There, Anderson stressed how so many natural processes are interconnected, or coupled. CO2 in the atmosphere, the Arctic ice mass, tornadoes in the Midwest, temperate climates in northern Europe, wildfires in California, and whether Florida is above or below sea level, it's all connected. And a change in anything is going to cause changes, sometimes large changes, in everything else. That's why Anderson thinks the term global warming is a bad one. Global warming understates the severity of the disruption, and it understates the many dimensions of the disruption. On a somewhat encouraging note, last week Anderson argued that our country's failure to address global warming is to a large extent a matter of politics and economics. A lot of big wealthy corporations and big wealthy individuals have a vested interest in extracting and burning fossil fuels. In fact, Anderson argues that alternative energy would be better for the country's economy. Anderson doesn't downplay the problems energy conversion will create, but he implies that the political and economic power problems outweigh the technical problems. For Anderson, electricity is the power of the future and the present, and we can generate the stuff without burning hydrocarbons. It's good to hear an established mainstream figure say these things. When establishment figures talk like this, maybe more people will listen. But let's not forget that more radical figures have been saying these things for years. Radical figures such as political scientist Michael Parenti and singer David Rovics. And we shall hear from both of them today, if the gods permit. But first, let us return to James Anderson. The first question he addresses is whether living in Boston shaped his understanding of climate change.
Well, the immediate answer to that question is that I'm in chemistry, chemical biology department, earth and planetary sciences department, and the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences at Harvard. So this is a profoundly rich mixture of colleagues who understand these issues end to end. And then there's the Harvard University Center for the Environment that couples science into the Kennedy School, Law School, Business School, Medical School, School of Public Health. And the way in which that links into economics and politics and joins science, economics, and politics together is a really unique opportunity. So there's that aspect to it. And then when you live on the coast, you realize that sea level rise, which is inexorably coming from the melting of glacial systems, particularly in Greenland and the West Antarctic ice shelf, you realize how vulnerable coastal cities are. And Harvard is investing billions of dollars to build a new campus just across the Charles River that's only a meter and a half above sea level. Well, the nominal forecast for sea level rise by the end of the century, only a quarter of the length of time Harvard has been a university, is somewhere between 2 and 3 meters with a tail running out to 6 to 7 meters. So immediately building in Alston raises the question, well, what's going to happen when sea level rises and those buildings start to go underwater? So, yeah, Boston is a fantastic place to study climate.
Many scientists have tried to find a way to measure change in climate change, but one of the most notable, I think, is that they suggested to try to use average global temperature to measure the change. Do you think this is a correct way to measure?
No, I think it's the least articulate way of studying what's occurring, because when you look at global mean temperature, the dominant control over global mean temperature involves the inflow of heat into the ocean and into the land mass and into the ice systems. Well, the oceans cover 70% of the area of the Earth, and they have an average depth of 3,500 meters, and they have massive heat capacity, the oceans, that is. So a lot of heat can pour into the ocean before there's any measurable temperature change. The thing you have to look at is the measure the flow of heat into, for example, the ice structures, the cryospheric system, and you realize that tiny, tiny amount of inflow of heat can completely destroy the ice systems, because the heat of fusion of water is so small that all of these ice systems are profoundly delicate. And so defining this in terms of the increase in global mean temperature is the worst way to describe the severity of the problem.
For yourself, what do you think is the best thing to do to prevent global warming for now?
Well, there actually, when you look at the numbers on the rate of onset of, for example, the loss of ice systems in the Arctic, and you look at the paleo record, where you track the relationship between ice systems, global climate structure, temperature, and carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere from, say, the Eocene 40 million years ago, you come to the very immediate quantitative conclusion that three things are going to be necessary. We have to terminate adding more CO2 to the atmosphere, because we're now at 400 parts per million CO2, but we have to add another 90 parts per million from the combination of methane, N2O, and the CFCs. So we're at almost 500 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. At 500 parts per million CO2, the paleo record shows that there are no ice structures in the northern hemisphere at that level. And when you destroy the ice structures in the northern hemisphere, you destroy the temperature difference between the equator and the pole that drives the fundamental climate structure. So that tells you immediately that you have to do three things. You have to stop adding CO2 to the atmosphere and methane and N2O immediately. You have to draw CO2 back down below 300 parts per million to reach a stable state. And then you have to cool the planet to reform those ice structures, and you have to do that very, very gently. But all three of those are required, and that's just an unfortunate fact.
How would you convince people to believe that we are causing global warming?
Well, first of all, I think this is always an issue about generational investment for the next generation. That's just human nature, and it's a very important point that you make. That a lot of people would say, well, look, rather than making an intelligent decision to switch to solar renewables and wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, let's just continue to burn fossil fuels and create instabilities for not just our grandchildren, but for our children. Because the U.S. military is a very important organization to look at. They deem climate change as equally destabilizing as nuclear armaments. And so that determines the seriousness of the problem, because the military has to be responsible quite often, ultimately, for political instability worldwide. We always move in with the military, sometimes effectively, sometimes not. So there's that aspect to it. But that brings us back to the question of the degree of irrefutability of the information that we have on climate change. And here is where two institutions have failed us. One is the government strategic structure for analyzing the physics and chemistry of climate change, because there are many, many observations that are required that will profoundly point out how serious the problem is and how rapidly things are changing. For example, we have limited ocean observations of the flow of heat in underneath the Arctic ice cap, the West Antarctic ice shelf. We have very limited observations about the coupling of severe storms into the stratosphere to destroy ozone. We don't understand the physics of deep convective storms that generates this convective injection that is responsible for very intense storms over the United States. We have no forecasts of drought. We don't know if the California drought is going to last 2 years, 20 years, 200 years, or 2,000 years. We simply don't have the forecasts. We don't have a forecast of sea level rise that's trusted. So we have a huge breakdown in the viability of our research structure related to defining quantitatively climate change. And until we make even a modest investment in that, we'll never have the information. The second aspect, the second institution that's culpable are the universities, for the point I made before. The curricula in universities across the country, and there are 2 million students that graduate from U.S. universities each year, they walk away the morning of their graduation with a diploma without the faintest idea what the fundamental facts are in the linkage between climate and energy generation. And so they're susceptible to misinformation by the fossil fuel industry. If you watch a presidential primary debate and you know the facts around energy and climate, you're shocked by the completely fallacious answers that come out of presidential candidates' mouths. And ostensibly, this is run by a journalistic institution that is organizing the debate. But the journalists involved in this don't know the facts themselves to call the candidates on misinformation. So the government and the federal research structure has to step up and deal with the scope and the scale of climate change through a research program that's actually capable of diagnosing specifically what's going on, and the universities have to step up and develop curricula that produces knowledge in those graduates, 2 million a year, that allows them to make clear, concise judgments about the future. And of course, those students have a couple of parents, so when they come home in the middle of term and the parents say, well, what did you learn this term for my $40,000? Those students can come back and they can say, well, I understand this about climate structure and I understand that about primary energy generation, and these are facts that need to be acted on. So, in fact, it's 6 million people a year affected by a good university curriculum. And 10 times 6, that's 60 million people in a decade. Universities have to step up and take responsibility for that.
How vulnerable do you think we are towards climate change right now?
Yeah. Well, we're profoundly vulnerable. Look at what's happening in California, and look what's happening in the Northwest. The Columbia River Basin has less snowpack this year than any time in recorded history. The frequency and intensity of severe storms that sets in April and runs all the way through August, that creates a belt from Oklahoma to Wisconsin for severe storms that's doing terrible damage. The frequency and intensity are increasing. Sea level rise is increasing, but so too are severe storms that bring storm surges to the coast. You look at Norfolk, Virginia, for example, which is a major naval base. It's now under serious duress in rising water. The entire southern third of Florida goes underwater with just a 3 meter sea level rise. So I think we have a profound problem because all of this is irreversible. We can't just stop adding CO2 to the atmosphere. We've already loaded it to the degree where these events are inexorable.
Do you think that climate change in an overall scale is still a debatable topic?
No, only amongst the uninformed. It's only viewed as a debatable topic because of the misinformation that's pumped into the system by the fossil fuel industry. I mean, not only do they spend billions of dollars on misinformation, they support candidates who deny climate change, and that keeps the debate open. It's very similar to what happened during the tobacco smoking lung cancer era in this country, where the tobacco industry did everything it could to cast doubt on the relationship between smoking and lung cancer. And it delayed action on cigarette smoking by decades. And it's, in fact, Naomi Oreskes has demonstrated in her book, Merchants of Doubt, that not only are the same tactics being applied to climate denial, but the same people are at the center of developing that strategy to inject misinformation into the system. So it appears to be a debate, when in fact it's not a debate.
At the same time as they were going nuts building highways around the U.S. and to a somewhat lesser extent all over Europe and elsewhere in the 60s and 70s and 80s, they were also building nuclear reactors all over the place. All the countries that could afford to were doing it, pretty much. Denmark being an exception. And the exception was the cause of a mass movement. Just like the highway here. It was in the 1970s. The fuel crisis had begun. The choices were presented to us, as if we had none. Leaders of industry say that they could solve the problem by mastering the power of the radioactive atom. Some folks in Western Jutland got a notion in their heads. They thought there might be something they could offer up instead. A few hundred people gathered at a little place called Tvind and declared their will to harness the power of the wind. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. Some of them were scientists, the vast majority were not. But they knew with years of effort, you could do a lot. Word about the project spread far. 100,000 visitors came to help and to advise. Until one day these windmill builders drove in with a crane and lifted up their giant wings with a mighty chain. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill. When Tvindkraft was completed, it reached up to the sky. Its wings churned in the air at 54 meters high. The critics all fell silent. No one now was jeering, as even industry agreed. This was some damn fine engineering. The wind regaled Jutland from the North Atlantic Sea as it was seamlessly converted into electricity. It was power for the people, leukemia for none, when they declared in Denmark, just south of the midnight sun. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. They gave away the patents. They said knowledge should be free. And their plans were copied by a newborn industry. Soon Denmark would be known as a windmill-building nation. And it all started with some hippies at the Tvindkraft power station. Debates were held in parliament about which way things should go. Build a nuclear reactor, the majority said no. It could have gone quite differently. In much of the world it did. Except for those in Ulfborg who said we're getting off the grid. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world.
David Rovics with a true story of wind-powered electricity in Denmark, a much saner alternative to nuclear energy. Here are two of the 98 good arguments against nuclear. One, nuclear electricity is not and has never been economically competitive compared with electricity generated by coal, oil, or natural gas. And today, it's also not competitive with solar and possibly wind-generated electricity either. Two, a huge amount of fossil fuels are burned to extract, refine, and concentrate the uranium used as nuclear fuel. The ultimate carbon footprint of nuclear power is just as dirty as that of coal power. Nuclear power is neither a clean nor a viable alternative to anything. But I digress. Today, even much of the establishment has turned against fossil fuels and climate change. It's about time. Typically, Michael Pareti beat them to it by a decade or two. Here is a studio recording Pareti made in 2006. It's called Eco-Apocalypse.
Eco-apocalypse. The life support systems of the entire ecosphere, the planet's thin skin of air, water, and topsoil, are threatened by global warming, ozone depletion, and overpopulation. Global warming is caused by tropical deforestation, power plants, and most of all, motor vehicle exhaust and other fossil fuel emissions that hold the Earth's heat in and create a greenhouse effect, trapping the heat close to the Earth's surface. International panels of scientific experts have voiced their alarm at the accelerated rate of destabilizing climate changes. And what do we have in the U.S.? We have such dangerous fools as former Senator Steve Sines, Republican of Idaho, who said that if he had to choose between capitalism and ecology, he would choose capitalism. The senator doesn't get it, does he? Without a viable ecology, there will be no isms of any kind to choose. The 1990s were the warmest decade on record, with 1997 the warmest year of the 20th century, until 1998, which in turn was surpassed by 1999 and 2000. And the last few years, we also, again, getting record heats. Carbon dioxide, the most common of greenhouse gases, has increased by about 25% since the mid-1800s. These buildups are altering the climatic patterns on which we depend for our rainfall, resulting in meteorological aberrations across much of the planet, including record hurricanes and windstorms. Global warming is causing the Arctic ice caps and the Greenland glaciers to melt at an accelerated rate, affecting a rise in sea levels that is already beginning to inundate shorelines and small islands and bring severe floods, droughts, and disrupting natural ecosystems. In northern climates, as well as warmer ones, rising temperatures have diminished soil moisture, thereby disrupting the ability of forests to renew themselves and contributing to more forest fires. Global warming is playing havoc with the breeding habits of wildlife and threatening species with extinction through the release of new viruses and increased vulnerability to disease. Global warming also puts humans at risk by inflicting more heat, stress, air pollution, infectious disease, and droughts. Unless we can move away from fossil fuels and toward wind and solar power, the compounding effects of global warming are likely to bring utter disaster to the entire planet. Another potential catastrophe is the shrinkage of the ozone layer that shields us from the sun's deadliest rays. About 2.6 billion pounds of ozone-depleting chemicals, chiefly chlorofluorocarbons, are emitted into the Earth's atmosphere every year. The top five CFC polluters in the United States are corporate military contractors. U.S. space shuttles also have disastrously damaging effects on the ozone layer. Yet the space program goes on and on. Capitalism's modus operandi is to produce and sell at an ever-expanding rate, treating the world's resources as limitlessly expendable. But the Earth is finite, as is its water supply, oxygen, topsoil, an ability to absorb toxins, an ability to absorb heat from energy consumption. An infinitely expanding capitalism and a fragile, finite ecology appear to be on a calamitous collision course. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
Michael Parenti, Eco-Apocalypse, from a decade back. Preceding that were David Rovics, singing in Boston in January 2013, very nicely recorded by Chuck Rosina. And before that, Harvard scientist James G. Anderson. And many thanks to Dale Lehman for the original recording. Many thanks to you, too, for listening to New World Notes. And to the good folks at WWUH-FM in West Hartford, Connecticut. And the good folks at other community stations that carry this show. For instance, station KRFP-FM, Radio Free Moscow, that beacon of light in darkest Idaho. Thanks, too, to the good folks at RadioForAll.net, who make recordings of the show easily available to listeners and to radio stations worldwide. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising, illegitimi non carborundum, keep the aspidistra flying, remember you are not alone, and please come back again next week. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm joined on the show by journalist James Henry, who's currently working for the organization WhoWhatWhy.com and has been recently investigating the Boston Marathon bombing. After an injury ended his career in the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning trade, he went back to college to get a degree in communication with a lot of focus on media studies. The insights he gained into how public opinion is formed and manipulated by the news, entertainment, advertising, and public relations industries profoundly affected the way he viewed the world. He began to see how it was possible for the government and media to lead a nation into a bloody war under false pretenses. More specifically, how the news media failed to question what they were being told by interested government agents and instead joined in beating the drums of war. And since much of what he learned had essentially ruined his ability to pursue a job in the mainstream communications industry, he was lucky to come across Russ Baker's Who, What, Why, which is not afraid to resist the herd mentality and ask the uncomfortable questions. Having grown up in Massachusetts and having family connections to Boston, he was deeply disturbed by the marathon bombing and felt compelled to reach out to Russ about a series of problems he was seeing with the official version of events. He was asked to join the team doing research for the site and soon began writing his own articles. James Henry, welcome to the show.
Hi, Cheryl. It's good to speak with you.
You've been doing some research with Russ Baker at Who, What, Why on the Boston Marathon bombing that occurred on April 15th, 2013. Can you just refresh our memory a little bit what the official story is regarding the Boston Marathon bombing?
Sure. So generally, their brothers, both Tamerlan and Johar, are accused of placing backpacks individually near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. They're both accused of detonating those bombs, and they claim to have no idea who these people were, and they had to dig through all thousands and thousands of digital photography to zero in on a couple of suspects. And they said publicly that at least Johar is seen dropping his bag, but they've been sort of strangely mum on exactly what proofs they have as to Tamerlan's role in dropping the bag, that is. So then days went on. There was days of media speculation. Nobody really knew what to expect. And the government zeroed in on who the suspects were. And it's Thursday the 18th, 3 days after the bombing, at about 5:30 p.m., the FBI did a press conference where they showed pictures of the two suspects. This is the infamous white hat and black hat photographs that were sort of grainy and hard to see exactly who they were. But the story is that the brothers recognized that they were wanted, and they gathered up a pistol and a machete and BB guns or whatever that would be good for. And then they apparently decided they need more weaponry, according to the government. So they went to MIT and shot and killed Officer Sean Collier while sitting in his cruiser. There were, of course, differing accounts of how that all went down, but we can get into that later. They then tried to steal his weapons, apparently were unsuccessful, so they abandoned the effort and decided to drive over to the Alston neighborhood of Boston, where they carjacked the anonymous Danny. So he's the Chinese student from Northeastern who's an entrepreneur who says the brothers tapped on his window, showed him a gun, said they wanted his car, they wanted money, and then they drove to Watertown with the carjacking victim, Danny, where they retrieved items out of the brothers were driving a green Honda Civic at the time when they did the carjack. So Tamerlan got in the car with the carjacking victim. Johar followed behind with the green Honda Civic. They drove to Watertown, retrieved items out of the Honda Civic, put them in the carjacking victim's Mercedes SUV, They both hopped in, drove back to Cambridge looking for ATMs, forced the carjacking victim to take out, I think, $800 out of his bank account, and they then realized the Mercedes SUV was low on gas. So this is where they allegedly drove into a Shell station on Memorial Drive in Cambridge, and Jahar went out to pump the gas, realized it was a cash only where he had to go inside and pay, which you'd think they would have done anyway since they'd just taken $800 from the gentleman's bank account. But anyway, Jahar went in to pay for gas. Tamerlan stayed in the car with the carjacking victim. And while Tamerlan was allegedly fiddling with a GPS device, the carjacking victim, Danny, made a daring escape, ran across the street to a mobile station, screaming and yelling to the clerk in there that he's been carjacked, that people were trying to kill him, and that he hid in the back room. So long story short on that, carjacking victim Danny called the police from the mobile station, and he told them both that he had left his iPhone in the car and that it had Mercedes tracking. So it's not really clear how they actually tracked the vehicle, but it was supposed to be one of those two methods. The car was tracked to Watertown, where a uniformed police officer driving his cruiser spotted the vehicle described in the Bolo, beyond the lookout. He started to follow them, did not turn on his lights, and this is where, allegedly, Tamerlan jumps out of the vehicle and just starts unloading his pistol into the police officer's cruiser. The cruiser backed off and called for backup. Other police responded, and a big infamous shootout ensued right on Laurel Street near the corner of Dexter Avenue. And one of the neighbors happened to get some photos of it, went all over the internet. Very grainy, hard to say exactly who they are, but they do generally appear to be the brothers. And then the older brother, Tamerlan, who apparently was the one holding the gun, also during this shootout, I should say, somebody, one of the brothers, threw some sort of explosive. They're alleged to have thrown an explosive at the police. It blew up in the middle of the street. And then Tamerlan was sort of taken from the side. A police officer had come around from a backyard, started shooting at him from the side. Tamerlan turned, started shooting at him. His gun jammed, threw a gun at the officer, turned around and started charging the other officers off the street, and he was tackled from behind by the officer who had been shooting at him from the side. The younger brother allegedly jumped in the SUV, turns it around, and while trying to blast through the police barricade, runs over his brother, who's being apprehended in the middle of the street, speeds down to Spruce Street and abandons the vehicle there. Somehow he got away from the police. Then, into the next evening, he was on the run, hiding in a boat, a dry dock boat, in somebody's yard, and the neighbor found that something was amiss with the tarp covering his boat, looked inside, saw blood, saw a figure, backed out, called the police. So, as you can imagine, the area was swarmed with probably hundreds of law enforcement with itchy trigger fingers at that point, and despite the fact that Jahar did not have a gun, but a gunfire erupted. The brother was ultimately apprehended. It turned out he did not have a gun. From that point on, he was brought to jail, and that was essentially the official turn of events.
So where does it begin to fall apart? I know in your research you said that the witness, Danny, who had the car that was supposedly hijacked, it sounds like we don't even know who he is. We don't know his name. Nobody's met him but a few reporters, according to some of the articles I read on your site. Could you talk about that?
Sure. That was one of the most troubling aspects right up front. Was most people were very open about who they were, and particularly victims. And this one in particular wanted to remain anonymous. And what's so crucial to him is the fact that allegedly the older brother said to him, "I am the Boston bomber and I just killed a cop." Right off the bat, decided to admit all of these incriminating things to a victim that they were supposedly just wanted money from. So his existence is critical to the story. But the problem with his account is that he had interviews with about three different journalists face to face, and in three different, or four actually, maybe even a fifth, but the most high profile were three major ones, and there were differing accounts of what he said on key details to these journalists. Now, most of this is chalked up by your average person as, well, it's just media confusion. The media always gets things wrong, but the point is, these journalists would probably not miss these key details about how you escaped, and this was where the story kept changing. When he initially spoke with a New Hampshire that he had simply been let go, that the brothers were done with him, they got his money, and they said, see you later, get out of here, whatever the case was. And he ran off and told the police what happened. Then days later, he was interviewed by a reporter of the Boston Globe alongside a criminologist from Northeastern who sort of was alongside of him. It was just a little bit odd that he had to bring somebody along with him to this interview. The long story short is the escape story suddenly changed from I was let go to I escaped while they weren't looking. And he also said that the brother had been in the car with him, or that both brothers were in the car. Neither one of them had ever gotten out. The key fact is he said one brother was still in the car with him while the other brother went inside. And then in another account, when he spoke with another journalist, he told yet another version one brother was in the car fiddling with a GPS, and the third version is they both got out of the car. One of them was pumping the gas while the other one went inside to get stuff, snacks, or whatever the case was. So we have three different versions of events, and it just brings into serious question what it is he's saying.
Right, and I think the part that is interesting to me is that we don't know his identity. And I know that he was interviewed by a John Miller. And in one of the articles I read on the Who, What, Why website, it says that John Miller was actually went from being a journalist to working for the government intelligence community. And maybe you could talk a little bit about those connections.
Well, you don't really have anything clear and factual on that other than exactly what you just said, is that it is troubling for a gentleman like John Miller, who so easily eases in and out of journalism and then national security, clear conflicts of interest there. He has connections to the world that he should be scrutinizing and probably loyalties, you know, like most people in any profession. You know, he claims that he can ethically skirt that divide without any trouble, but it certainly raises questions about whether or not he's going to ask tough questions of people feeding him information anonymously, or some of his colleagues may be feeding him the information, and he's not going to challenge them.
Yeah, there's a clear conflict of interest there for him because I think it said at the time he was a spokesman for the FBI Office of National Intelligence, which oversees the CIA and the FBI. So clearly a journalist with some ties to the intelligence community.
Yeah, and just to add one more thing to that, there are other shadowy characters around this couple of young men. You know, the uncle was married to the daughter of Graham Fuller, high up in the CIA. Obviously not anything direct, but it certainly raises questions about how they were brought to the country and what the circumstances were. And even the mysterious college professor that says he gave Jahar lessons in his Chechen background, which is innocuous, but at the same time, that makes you wonder about questions to the Central Intelligence Agency and all of the national security implications working around the region they hail from.
Right, and I understand that the older brother, Tamerlan, was on the U.S. watch list since 2011, and he gets to go overseas and back and forth. And in the beginning, they said they had no contact, they didn't know who he was, and then they had to admit that they did. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's exactly one of the big red flags to us, is that they weren't very forthcoming about knowing who these characters were, and then Russia pipes up, hey, wait a minute, we sent you warnings back in 2011, do you remember? And then, oh, yes, well, we investigated it, but it turned out it was no big deal. We were concerned for his civil liberties, so we didn't investigate further. You know, as we know, with the FBI has been following Muslim people around the country, it's kind of a stretch of the imagination since that they were overly concerned with his civil rights.
Right. So we have this witness, Danny, the eyewitness who said that the brother confessed that they had done the job and murdered the police officer. We don't know Danny's real name, and only a few select people in the media have had a chance to interview him, one being this John Miller, who has connections to the CIA, FBI, or the intelligence community. And then there were several articles I read on your website about witnesses being intimidated by the FBI. Can you talk a bit about that? What's happening to the witnesses and friends of these two brothers?
Sure. And just generally on that, it's troubling to see that if this is such a slam dunk, open and shut case, it's kind of strange that they're going to such extreme lengths to try to silence any opposition or anybody that could possibly support the defendant in this mess. that right there is troubling. But
yeah.
So what happened down in Florida is especially troubling. How a friend of Tamerlan, Ibrahim Kodashev, he was followed around for weeks by the FBI overtly. He knew they were watching him, someone could argue, to the point of harassment. And it appears that they were ratcheting up the pressure on this individual. They were well aware that he had a violent history with martial arts expert that was very trained in mixed martial arts and probably had been advised that he had an explosive temper. And so with all that said, they do this marathon interview with him in his hot apartment. And instead of doing it in a secure area, there's swords on the walls, there's coffee tables, there's all this potential problematic stuff with this person who allegedly has a hot temper. They're ratcheting up the pressure on him, and then all of a sudden, apparently, he slips out, and it ends with his death. So, I mean, that is extremely troubling. The FBI agent who pulled the trigger, come to find out, has a history of questionable behavior in Oakland as a police officer, and then mysteriously gets a job with the FBI after having left Oakland on disability. So, that's another strange situation raising flags.
Wasn't this Ibrahim Todashev shot in the head 7 times?
He was. He was shot in the top of the head, and I'm not exactly sure about the specifics of where the bullet hit him. I know there are serious questions about the body positioning and how he was shot, you know, whether or not he was trying to get away or whether he was charging the police officer. There are questions about. I've not been a particular area that I'm well-versed in.
Okay. This Mr. Todashev had a girlfriend, and I understand they harassed her. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, she was detained, questioned, and she had actually been contacted by a reporter from Boston Magazine. She did an interview with one of their reporters, and she raised a lot of questions about whether or not her boyfriend had even been in Watertown during the triple murder for which she was being questioned at the time of being shot. She disclosed the level of harassment that has been happening with the FBI with her dead boyfriend. And soon thereafter, she was visited by the FBI. She was brought in. She was detained for a length of time and ultimately deported for, you know, having nothing to do with Boston Marathon bombing. She was deported on a very questionable justification. But it had the appearance of, after having spoken to the media and raising any sort of questions, legitimate or otherwise, he was silenced by being sent out of the country. And that happens to be the case with a lot of the other individuals connected to the Sarnas. Most of them are not American citizens and are extremely vulnerable to deportation. There was a friend of Ibrahim Todashev who had left the country to go to a family function in Central Asia. When he tried to come back, he was not allowed back in the country. And again, he had been one who spoke to the media and raised a few questions about the means and the method by which the FBI questioned his friend. So he was persona non grata, not left back into the country. It's just a series of individuals that had nothing to do with the bombing, not accused of having anything to do with the bombing, but the fact is they could potentially have information about the legitimacy of what the government is saying, and they just don't want trouble, so they're just sending people out of country.
Yeah, weren't they also closing their bank accounts and that sort of thing to harass them?
Yeah, there is an article on the website about it, whowhatwhy.com, where one of the writers for Who What Why discovers that Houthi Care, which is the Islamic organization, advocacy organization, they discovered that some of their members have had their bank accounts mysteriously closed by banks who basically have the right to shut your account for no particular reason. And these people just also happen to be connected to friends of Tamerlan and or Ibrahim Todashev.
Interesting. What's the impact all this having on the upcoming trial? I guess it's going to start in January for Johar?
It does. It starts in January. You know, understandably, emotions are running high right now. I don't know if you've seen any of the clips on the news about the little showdown at the courthouse there between supporters, quote-unquote, of Johar Tsarnaev versus one of the victims. But understandably, emotions are running high. There's been a political correctness climate. climate has developed in Boston about questioning anything about the government's version of events is anathema to sacrilege or un-American or downright lunacy. So it unfortunately devolved into a black and white kind of situation in that regard. Yeah, the trial is coming up fast. We're sifting through court documents as fast as we can, trying to see if the mainstream press is reporting what they should be reporting in there, and we've picked out a few interesting items in there, like specifically that early on the government was claiming they had forensic evidence that Amerlin was involved in triple murder, and then come to find out when the younger brother asked for the evidence, or when his lawyer did, they said, well, there is no evidence he participated in the murder other than Khodishev's alleged confession, which even that is questionable. When Ibrahim Khodishev was shot dead, just prior to that, he had confessed that he and Tamerlan participated in the triple murder in Waltham. That's what he was being questioned about.
And we only know that from the FBI who were there and killed him.
Exactly. There is one thing to that. The only other witness to that crime was the girlfriend of one of the three murder victims in Waltham. She walked in the door and saw the crime scene, and what she saw did not exactly match the way Ibrahim Khodishev said to the FBI it had happened. So, there's some questions about the legitimacy of his alleged confession.
Right, and so you just wrote a recent article about how the prosecution had to admit that they didn't have evidence for these slayings. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it speaks to a tendency we've seen in this from the beginning, and it is anonymous law enforcement leaks that early on are picked up by the media. They're widely disseminated, and in every instance, they have a sort of a damning effect that, okay, yes, look, this brother, there's mounting evidence, one of the articles says, that he was involved in the crime in Waltham. The government has forensic evidence, and this is around as, okay, well, yes, it's quite plausible that this person committed the murder. But then later on, in court documents, we see that that was actually false, that they, other than a confession that made by a man who was clearly under duress and got shot to death, other than that confession, the government then later admits quietly that they do not have much evidence or forensic. So it's a pattern we've been seeing that when everyone's paying attention, there's a series of law enforcement leaks that get picked up, spread around by the mainstream media, and then later on, the evidence turns out to be dubious at best or non-existent at worst. So that's essentially what that article's about. It's bumped to the second page by now. I'm on the whowhatwhy.com website. It'll be retrieved by typing in Barnett Evidence or Boston Marathon, and all the articles on the topic will come up.
Okay, great. Yeah, and again, the website is whowhatwhy.com. So we have an eyewitness that we don't know. His name is Danny. We have another confession by Khodishev, who's dead. The evidence they have is really kind of questionable, correct?
Well, it's hard to say. There's been very tight-lipped and very, even with the defense team that's supposed to be given access to exculpatory or any kind of evidence, they've been very unwilling to share any information. So it's hard to say. Jahar guilty or innocent of the particular charges against him? I don't really know based on evidence that the government may or may not have. But it certainly appears, with all the indicators we've seen throughout this, that there is some sort of troubling cover-up afoot, whether it be related to their prior relationship with the brothers, or whether it's related to the fact that maybe they were following them around, and that maybe they knew he was more of an extremist than they're letting on, or would be some sort of an informant, which is something that's been very commonly done, particularly with, you know, these young men have multilingual mastery in multiple languages from rare regions of the world that not everybody could speak. I mean, you could certainly build a scenario where they would be valuable assets in the world of, well, spy versus spy.
Or they could be patsies, sort of like Lee Harvey Oswald, correct?
Well, I mean, that's entirely possible. Whether or not that's the case, I'm not sure. I don't want to really speculate too much on that. But there are a lot of troubling parallels between, say, Lee Harvey Oswald, for instance, and when he allegedly gunned down a police officer in the middle of the street. next thing you know, the gloves come off, and all of a sudden law enforcement kick into high gear, and it's an absolute miracle that even one of them survived, having been being riddled with bullets. So there are a lot of troubling parallels, and whether or not it's the case.
Can you speak to, there was a, after Tamerlane was supposedly shot and then run over by his brother, you can see a picture of him online where he's naked with, and the police are standing around him. Do you have anything to add to that?
You know, I've seen it, and it is very interesting, to say the least. I tried to get information on it from various law enforcement agencies, and basically nobody will talk about it. They will not provide any information on, okay, so this gentleman was allegedly let go and not found not to be a suspect. Well, since it didn't have anything to do with the bombing, can we have some information on it? We don't need his name, but so there's nothing. They will not share any of this. Whether or not it was Tamerlane, it's hard to say. I'm not a facial recognition person. He certainly resembled him. He was strong and looked pretty similar build and all, but I really don't know what the story is on that. It is strange, again, the person has not come forward. You think that would be very newsworthy. He had absolutely nothing to be ashamed of. You know, it wasn't like he did anything embarrassing. So you would think he'd be interested to say, hey, I'm the guy that got apprehended accidentally.
Right. Let me ask you, James, why is knowing about what happened in the Boston Marathon important?
Well, it's important because it was the biggest terrorist attack since 9/11 to happen in our country. It's important because it, of course, justifies a lot of the ramping up of the police apparatus, and not just the police, but national security in general. You know, we're seeing results right now of allowing these agencies carte blanche to do things in secrecy without any accountability. And with the torture report that just came out, we're seeing probably the tip of the iceberg of how troubling it is when these institutions are not held accountable and not forced to operate in the light of day. It just breeds corruption and behavior like we saw with the torture stuff. So, you know, when then an event like this happens again, I think we all need to be careful in accepting law enforcement and the national security apparatus's version of events. We need to be highly skeptical of it. And we also need to realize that these are the events that are slowly eroding our control over our own government.
Right.
Sort of the outside threat thing is when people acquiesce any sort of control over their democracy.
Well, James Henry, unfortunately, we're out of time. I really want to thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me. I just want to remind listeners that you can follow Who What Why on Facebook and Twitter, and that Who What Why is a not-for-profit, nonpartisan news outlet.
Right, and the website is whowhatwhy.com. And again, that was a recent interview with James Henry of whowhatwhy.com. According to a recent poll, 4 in 10 Bostonians are skeptical of the official account of the Boston Marathon bombing. The trial of the younger brother, Jokar Sarnaev, is scheduled to begin on January 5th, 2015, in Boston. And on a final note today, in a recent article from the American Free Press by Ronald L. Ray, dated October 26, 2014, a German journalist, Dr. Udo Ulf Kote, has written a book called Gekaufte Journalisten, or literally, Bought Journalists. In the new bestseller, he reveals the rampant cooperation of the media with intelligence agencies, transatlantic organizations, banks, corporations, and billionaires. As of October 26th, when this article first appeared, the book was not out in English yet, but hopefully it is by now. It's certainly worth checking out. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. We turn our attention to education. Carol Burris, principal of Southside High School in Rockville Center for 15 years and an outspoken critic of Common Core standards and related testing, left that post to fight what she says are harmful educational reforms. Carol Burris has become executive director of the Network for Public Education Foundation, assuming that position after serving as the principal of Southside High School since 2000. Dr. Burris has co-authored Detracking for Excellence and Equity and Opening the Common Core, How to Bring All Students to College and Career Readiness, and authored On the Same Track, How Schools Can Join the 21st Century Struggle Against Resegregation.
How are you, Mimi?
Well, we're good within the scheme of things. how do you see Trump's pick for Secretary of Education, Amway billionaire Betsy DeVos, seeking to transform the educational landscape of the United States in her position at the head of a department that has a role in overseeing the schooling of more than 50 million American children?
Well, in one word, train wreck. There are, I think, four compelling reasons why she should not lead the department. The first is she believes in unregulated schooling. Her allegiance is to the marketplace. It's not to children. And we know that because just this summer she spent well over $1 million in contributions to policymakers in order to try to limit regulations that would rein in some of the abuses in Michigan charter schools. Second is she supports the privatization of schooling, and she really is determined to destroy our democratically governed public school system. Her passion is for two things: the expansion of charter schools, especially for-profit charter schools, and vouchers to private and religious schools. She's also a big supporter of virtual schools, which are an absolute disaster. I mean, even charter school organizations have concerns about those. Third is, and this is one of the ones that worry me the most, is that her influence and her lobbying practices are ethically suspect. She proudly touts that her family is the biggest contributor of soft money to the Republican National Committee. A quote from Betsy is, "We've decided to stop taking offense at the suggestion that we are buying influence. Now I simply concede the point. We do expect something in return." I mean, that's chilling. Everybody knows it. But to have the audacity to say it is something else. And right now, she had illegally contributed to campaign funds in Ohio through her school choice PAC, resulting in a fine of over $5 million, and she has yet to repay that, or family funds have yet to repay that. And fourth is, you know, DeVos is unqualified. She never attended a public school. Her children never attended a public school. She's not an educator. She has no background in education. She is someone with strong right-wing opinions who believes that this is part of bringing the kingdom of God to America through her vision of reform of public schools. I mean, I just don't know how it could get worse.
Well, you know, if you can talk for a moment about, there's the Children First America, and then there's the American Education Reform Council and the American Federation for Children. Now, Betsy DeVos is not just an advocate. She's really virtually a zealot on privatizing education, whether it's through the parochial school process or the charter school process. Can you talk a little bit about these institutions that she's, or these organizations that she advocates for, her positioning there? And then let's get into the meat of the debate about
privatizing education, which seems to be the Kentucky Fried Children model seems to be most on the horizon.
Yeah, I mean, all of these organizations, and you know, I see it all the time, especially in the charter world, is they have very benevolent names, and some of them are 501c3s. They're allowed to do a certain amount of lobbying on the taxpayer dime, essentially, when you get a deduction, right? And then what you usually find is there's also a linked 501c4, and those are able to do things like endorse candidates. Then you'll have PACs that are spinoffs. And it's always a very tangled web trying to figure out who's behind, who's giving money. But this is, you know, the tools that her family uses in order to influence policy. And they've done it time and time again in this state of Michigan. I think I mentioned that they spent well over $1 million to limit the proposed regulations. But they also spent in Michigan $5.6 million in order to try to expand vouchers. Now, even in Michigan, that didn't fly, and that was a great disappointment to them, but that doesn't stop the DeVos family. And you have to think of Betsy also as part of a bigger network that includes her husband, Dick, who back in 2002, Dick DeVos was calling public schools government schools, right? So there was a very determined campaign through messaging to turn our nation against our neighborhood public schools that are governed by elected school boards. I mean, that's the government of public schools, right? Except for those cases where mayors have grabbed power in cities, but still there's an elected official behind it. The DeVos family doesn't want this, and when you look at the philosophy of what they support with those different groups that you mentioned, you see a pattern that believes that the market is the only way to provide good schooling, and that the way to deal with quality is to have parents and kids choose with their feet, right? And so when we have massive school, when we have school closures, for example, with a lot of these charters, very, very abrupt, or we have outright cases of fraud, or we have terrible models like cyber charters, you know, where kids who don't want to get up in the morning, their parents give in and send them to a cyber school. I mean, all of these things without regulation will mean that we're going to wake up in 10 years or in 20 years and have an electorate and a citizenry that is truly, truly undereducated. For me, it's very frightening.
Carol Burris, Trump campaigned on a platform proposing to assign $20 billion of federal funds to a block grant aimed at opening up school choice. The assumption is that the productive competition between schools will result. As he said, competition always does it. Trump said that if we were speaking about air-conditioned factories rather than, you know, academic institutions, the weak fall out and the strong get better. The problem, as you see it, with the particularly the voucher system, the privatization of education, because there are certainly people who are discouraged with the production and progress of the public school arena for their children. How do you respond to these issues?
Well, look, I mean, change can result in three outcomes, right? Things can get better, things can stay the same, or they can get worse. So privatization is going to make things worse, not better. And the evidence is there. You just mentioned vouchers a few moments ago. You know, there's no evidence. There's no good evidence, right? There are some think tanks that are designed to produce, you know, the results that they want. But when you look at the objective literature, there's nothing that lets us know that vouchers work. Students using vouchers were found to underperform traditional public school students in multiple states, including the state of Ohio. And that was a study by the Fordham Institute in 2016. The Fordham Institute is actually a very conservative education think tank. Even in New Orleans, right, what everybody thinks of as the hotbed of school choice, a study by the Education Research Alliance found that voucher student test scores have slipped below traditional public school counterparts between 8 to 16 percentile points. We know in the state of Indiana, for example, where Mike Pence expanded vouchers, not only is it not having a positive effect, what it's doing is it's causing a real problem in terms of loss of tax dollars. So you have, you know, the education sector, it can't seem to be able to budget enough money. It's always running in the red. Because what happens is people who would send their kids to private school anyway are now grabbing tax dollars for vouchers. And part of the problem, too, Mimi, is that the voucher systems that are out there give parents between $4,000 and $6,000. That's the average. Well, you can't get into a really good private school if you don't have the rest of the money, right? So two things happen. Either the people who would use who would be sending their kids anyway use the vouchers, or what happens is substandard private schools that are like the worst of the charters open up, and that's where parents wind up going. You know, there's no evidence that any of this works. Chile tried it. They created this horrible four-tier system based on the privatization ideas that have come, you know, for the last 30 years down the pike. With the Friedman Foundation. Mm-hmm. And what they had was this horrible system, very stratified in terms of SES, where you have municipal schools on the bottom, which is what is left of the public schools. And that's where basically the poor send their children, kids with learning disabilities, people who are disenfranchised. Then you have the charter schools, right? Then you have the voucher schools, and then finally the elite private schools, which are like Exeter and some of the elite private schools in this country. And now they're trying to unwind it. There's unrest in the streets. There are demonstrations. People want a good public school system back. But, you know, once you break that egg, it's really, really hard to put it back. Sweden's experiment with privatization has not worked well. Their PISA scores continue to drop. You look next door to Finland, which invested in an excellent public school system, put money in, made it more equitable for all kids, and you see the scores go up. So, you know, there's no evidence that any of this works. It's based on a belief and almost a hatred of our public school system, where children of all races and all economic backgrounds sit side by side. And, I mean, there are limitations to that because we have such segregated neighborhoods. But instead of working on those pieces, we're starting to work on these false solutions that are not benefiting kids. I mean, we're just not seeing any evidence of it. Privatization is not going to start with Betsy DeVos. Mm. Privatization's been underway now for quite a while.
Well, you know, one of the other things that DeVos had been talking about was that applying the logic of the marketplace to schoolyard precincts, she has repeatedly questioned the values of those very precincts, of the physical existence. She has remarked that in the internet age, the tendency to equate education with specific school buildings is going to be greatly diminished. That I find tremendously alarming. I have always seen, in its best instance, a school building within a specific precinct as a kind of heart and soul for the development. Or it certainly should be for the community, for the parents, for the learning experience. This is something that she really ideologically questions, which, as I said, I find quite alarming.
It is quite alarming. And, you know, when she's talking about that, too, she is not only talking about kids going willy-nilly on buses or trains or in their parents' cars to get to schools well outside their neighborhood. She's also talking about cyber schooling. And online schooling is a disaster. You know, I'm not a technophobe. I think technology has a place in education. But, you know, I came back recently from a trip to California where you see what they call these independent learning centers, right? There are schools in shopping malls, literally in shopping malls, that kids only need to attend 2 hours a week. The rest of their work is either packet work or it is work that they do online, right? Now, listen, if you're maybe a kid who, or a young adult who dropped out of school and now you're trying to get a diploma, something like that might make sense, but they're letting kids as young as seventh grade in these schools, as young as seventh grade.
Yeah.
You know, how do you know whether a child is being abused? How do you know whether a child is in that school because they're depressed? How do you develop a child socially and emotionally? These are all important functions of schooling you can't have in this cyber world. And the results are horrific. If you look at the graduation rates of cyber charters nationwide, it's 40%. 40%. And, you know, you have some much lower. I found some of these schools in California with 0% four-year graduation rates. What happens is you see tremendous scandals being associated with them. You have for-profit companies like K-12 in Virginia that become, the charters become fronts, right? So somebody will open up a little nonprofit organization in California, and then they buy all of their services, the curriculum, the teachers, everything from K-12. K-12 recently had to give millions of dollars back to the state of California because it was cooking the books on attendance, right? They were pretending kids were going and when they weren't going. It was a huge scandal in Pennsylvania with a cyber charter where this guy was making millions upon millions of dollars and buying houses and a jet. His name was Trombetta. They got him on tax evasion. He's going to be going to jail. You know, the cyber charters in the state of Pennsylvania get the same amount of money as brick-and-mortar charters. So that, for example, in the Bethlehem School District, for every kid that attends a cyber charter, the district has to pay $11,000 for each kid. Now, you know, in a cyber school, it's not costing them $11,000 a kid to educate the child. And this then drains all of the resources from districts. And then what they get is they get the kid back maybe in a couple of years, undereducated, or the kid just slips through the cracks and never becomes a graduate at all. And, you know, for her to say this is great shows one or two things. Either that she doesn't care at all about America's children, or she is woefully ignorant about what is going on. And I think both of those choices, they're just unacceptable for someone to lead our nation's schools.
Well, Carol Burris, we've just skimmed the surface and must continue this discourse. I mean, to me, the idea of people like DeVos, whose lodestar really has been her conviction that any non-traditional public education public school is better than a traditional one simply because it's not operated by the government, can't hold water and shouldn't. So we're going to continue to explore these very controversial issues. And I thank you for your extraordinary contributions. And as I said, you know, the idea that somebody left their work after decades because of her vocation to public education and to our children is the kind of guest that we need to have on. And Carol Burris, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thank you. And if I could just ask listeners, the Network for Public Education, and you can do that with, that's our website, www.networkforpublicEducation.org, has a toolkit to help oppose Betsy DeVos. And we give letters, sample letters. We give scripts for calling, how to get in touch with your senators, how to write a letter to the editor, give you samples, everything you need. We need everybody in this fight. No more sitting back, no more saying, let somebody else do it. Every person who is listening, who loves public education and believes it is the pillar of our democracy, needs to act, and they need to act fast.
Take it seriously. Let's be proactive instead of winding up being on the defensive and reactive. Let's oppose Betsy DeVos as Education Secretary. Thank you again, Carol Burris.
Thank you, Mimi. Bye-bye.
And now Brave New Films presents Protect Public Education, Stop Betsy DeVos.
The job of the Secretary of Education is to ensure that every community has quality education.
When I first heard about Betsy DeVos being nominated, I thought, oh God, no.
I hope she can be stopped.
Betsy DeVos was nominated by Donald Trump to be Secretary of Education. She is a very radical, extremist choice because she's actually opposed to public education.
In nominating DeVos, Trump makes it loud and clear that his education policy will focus on privatizing, defunding, and destroying public education in America. The New York Times notes DeVos helped turn her home state of Michigan into one of the nation's biggest school choice laboratories, and the result was disastrous.
If given the power and authority, she would eliminate public education and replace it with religious schools and charter schools.
Our desire is to continue to help advance God's kingdom.
The DeVos family, Betsy and her husband, they sponsored a referendum to change the state constitution so that money could flow to religious schools. And that referendum was defeated. Subsequently, Betsy DeVos and her husband have put their money into charter schools.
Charter schools are free public schools that receive state and federal funds. These schools are privately run.
Betsy DeVos and her family have helped to create the environment in the state of Michigan, which has many, many charter schools. There are some good charter schools, but there are not very many of them.
Here in Michigan, 70 to 80% are run by private for-profit companies. So while technically those schools are public schools, that public money goes to private for-profit.
The DeVos family spend money through their political action groups to run people against supporters of public education in states across the country.
We change policy through political effort to elect or defeat candidates in states based on this issue.
If you're looking at Michigan, our entire state is failing. And giving her this job based on that, it's a sin and a shame.
A lot of schools and people in authority are letting our children down.
Charter schools get the vast majority of their funding from the public, but they don't have the accountability mechanisms that public schools have to have.
Michigan has no accountability for charter schools. Michigan is now spending $1 billion a year on unregulated, unaccountable, unsupervised charter schools. The quality of education in the charter schools is worse than in the public schools.
These schools are doing worse than our traditional public schools.
They're not able to read at certain levels, even through high school.
All the parents want is greater choice for their children, and they're happy with how their kids are doing. If they're not happy, they change to another school.
My children have attended 27 schools trying to give them a quality education. I had 5 children in school. and they closed those schools down without any community input. In my city, charter schools can open and close whenever, wherever they want.
Three Detroit charter schools shut their doors forever.
This charter school suddenly closed its doors in the middle of the day.
Suddenly and unexpectedly closing its doors.
How much of that money is going to be returned now that it's closed?
Well, none, Bob. Not a penny. Everything, computers, furniture, paper, all of it bought with taxpayer dollars. The school has no students, but it gets to keep everything it bought.
What children are robbed of is the stability that they need to learn.
They had no regulations. They were changing management companies in the middle of the school year. And it wasn't the teachers. The teachers were awesome.
How long can you go year after year with not getting what you need, without not having an assistant in the classroom, overcrowded classes, not enough supplies, no prep time?
Who's going to benefit from that? Because it's not the children.
The best schools are those where children and teachers and parents work together, and where there's a good relationship where everybody is centered on helping the children do better.
Even after waiting in line, their kids may not get in because the line just got them in the building where they had to enter a lottery.
Not all of the parents and the students that apply are able to get into the program every year.
As districts lose their federal oversight, they do begin to resegregate.
Charter schools are a new form of modern-day segregation.
The more choices we have, the more competition we have.
But we don't have good choices in our city.
Wherever you hear the term school choice, remember that it was started initially by the Southern segregationists like George Wallace of Alabama and the many segregationists who, like him, wanted to keep the schools absolutely divided.
That's my fear, that we're going to go back 50, 60 years again, and that's what scares me.
Because of the lack of oversight, the administrators and the people in charge of these charter schools can do what they wish with the money. Research into that has found a lot of wrongdoing.
Our money is being mismanaged by people who are in it for the money.
In Philadelphia alone, at least 10 executives or top administrators have pled guilty in the last decade to charges like fraud, misusing funds, and obstruction of justice.
One of the charter schools my daughter attended, they didn't have books. They were making copies from the books and sending them home.
It funnels public money that should be going to public schools into charter schools, which of course leads public education to fail. And then the GOP turns around and says, look at these failing public schools. Let's shut them down.
Well, the DeVos agenda has already been proven to be one that ruins public schools.
And if you would hurt a great city like Detroit, what would you do to other cities that struggle, that have needs and really want to have a high quality education for their children?
The sidewalks were covered with parents, teachers, and students.
We're going to have to stand up for our public schools.
Make sure our kids get a quality education for their future.
We don't want this model throughout the United States.
Her intention is to make all of our schools charter.
You lured me in with the promise of a high quality education, and you've lied.
We have to show them the right way to do things.
Join together and defend public education.
We want everybody in America
to have a voice and to know that they do matter.
Public school needs to be safeguarded.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
I'm grateful for all that you've done to work with us to accomplish some amazing transformations over these last 7.5 years. The past few years have taught us anything. It's that people who love their country can change it.
I think the people now, in all groups, who deal with all issues, have been energized in a way that they will keep raising these issues to the new administration.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Israel's top justices refuse to court marriage equality, Tory MPs block queer-inclusive British sex ed, and we greet the era of Trump with an appreciative chorus of Obama Lang Syne. All that and much more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news interaffecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending January 14, 2017. Israel's High Court of Justice signaled during a hearing this week that achieving civil marriage equality for same-gender couples will have to come legislatively and not through the courts. A few members of the High Court told representatives of Agudah, a leading LGBT advocacy group that had filed a petition with the justices on behalf of several gay and lesbian couples, that we need to follow the law, and less than a kilometer from here is the Knesset. That's the name of Israel's national parliament. All matters concerning marriage and divorce in the country are handled by religious authorities, generally Jewish, Muslim, or Christian, rather than through civil agencies. Deputy Supreme Court President Eliakim Rubinstein claimed that because civil marriage is also not available to heterosexual couples in Israel, lesbian and gay couples would be no worse off. However, no mainstream faith community in Israel will marry a same-gender couple. The High Court's official ruling on the Agudah petition was postponed to an undetermined later date.
A January 13th story in the Times of Israel cites a TV news investigation's findings that several state-funded Jewish burial societies in the country are asking bereaved loved ones not to bury a deceased LGBT person in certain cemeteries. A burial society representative in the city of Rosh Ha'ayin is heard to say that, "We're not going to bury someone who keeps Torah and commandments next to one like that." The revelation has drawn outrage from LGBT activists, some religious leaders, and members of the Knesset. Oded Fried, who formerly led the LGBT advocacy group Agudah, noted that Israel has laws that ban this kind of discrimination, but we see they are simply not enforced. MP Yael German has called for an urgent hearing in the Knesset to address the issue.
Peru has taken baby steps towards the legal recognition of same-gender couples. A court ruled on January 9th that the country must recognize the civil marriage of Peruvian gay activist Oscar Ugatechi to his Mexican partner Fidel Oroche Reyes. The couple married in Mexico City, where it's legal, in 2010. Ugatechi filed suit after Peruvian officials denied his request to change the marital status on his passport. If it stands, the court ruling would only apply to civil marriages of same-gender couples legally performed outside Peruvian borders. Nevertheless, a spokesman for the government agency responsible for registering civil marriages in the South American country has vowed to appeal.
Civil marriage for same-gender couples is legal in Portugal, and after traveling a rocky road to get there, Polish TV journalist Jacob Kuczynski and his boyfriend David have been given special permission to get married on the Portuguese island of Madeira. According to a report in Pink News, their request had previously been denied, primarily because Polish authorities made it difficult for the couple to file the necessary paperwork. The couple's coming-out video went viral and drew stunningly homophobic comments, including being told to cut their throats and wanting to send them to the gas chamber. After becoming aware of the shocking comments, local Madera registry officials reconsidered the couple's paperwork and okayed the marriage. "If we can't get married in our country, we wanted to choose a place that is close to our hearts," explained David. "There are countries where it is easier to get marriage permission, but we chose Madera because we fell in love with this island a few years ago, and since then we visit it every year." Jacob said the whole experience has been like winning a war.
A new survey by Germany's Federal Anti-Discrimination Agency shows majority support for marriage equality. The report this week in the Deutsche Welle news outlet says 83% favor opening civil marriage to same-gender couples. More than 75% of the 2,000 people surveyed between October and November 2016 support allowing those couples to adopt children. Germany lags behind most other European countries that have already granted gay and lesbian couples equal marriage rights. Christine Luders leads the German Anti-Discrimination Agency. She called the registered life partnerships currently available to same-gender couples in Germany second-class marriages. But the survey also revealed entrenched prejudice against LGBT people in the country. Almost 20% consider homosexuality to be unnatural, and 40% say they find it unpleasant to see same-gender couples kissing. And the emerging far-right Anti-Equality Alternative for Germany political party, which currently enjoys about 15% public support, is cause for concern. Markus Ulrich of the German Lesbian and Gay Association describes the party as the small but dangerous alliance of religious fundamentalists, right-wing populists, and anti-feminist hardliners. However, LGBT rights activists can take heart that the survey also found that the younger and more educated the respondents were, the less opposed they were to civil marriage equality.
Conservative MPs in the UK have blocked plans for compulsory LGBT-inclusive sex and relationship education. Current law requires state schools to cover sex education only from a biological perspective. No British schools are required to teach students about the social or emotional aspects of sex or include sexual orientation in the discussion. An all-female group of MPs tabled an amendment in Parliament this week to the Children and Social Work Bill to make lessons on sex and relationships education, same-sex relationships, sexual consent, sexual violence, and domestic violence mandatory in all UK schools. But a committee of 10 Conservative and 5 Labour MPs rejected the amendment along party lines. Proponents of the changes say that the current curriculum is outdated for the smartphone generation of children who are exposed to the internet and influenced by social media. An Education Department spokesperson would only say that we are actively considering what further steps we could take to improve the quality and availability of sex and relationships education.
In other news, a transgender man in China has won what would be the country's first successful legal challenge to a wrongful workplace dismissal. The plaintiff, identified only as Chen, was fired after just a week on the job at a medical clinic in southwest China. While the court ruled he was illegally fired, the judge stopped short of requiring the company to issue a formal apology and didn't specify that the wrongful termination was related to Chen's gender identity. He was, however, awarded the equivalent of a month's salary in damages. The BBC noted that China's courts are not independent, and a politically sensitive case like this would almost certainly have attracted the attention of the country's central authorities. Analysts think Chen's case was settled to keep him from appealing, which would have brought even more attention to the issue. Chen told Britain's Guardian newspaper that this lawsuit was about three things: dignity, raising awareness of transgender and other sexual minorities, and pushing for anti-discrimination legislation. While he said he was satisfied with the ruling, Chen vowed to continue his political activism to expand the rights of China's emerging LGBTQ communities.
According to a new poll released this week by the giant Gallup organization, more than 10 million Americans, about 4.6%, now identify as LGBT. That's about 1.75 million more self-identified U.S. LGBT people than in a similar Gallup poll in 2012. The latest conclusions were based on data gathered over the past 5 years from more than 1.5 million randomly selected adults. Millennials drive virtually all of the increases observed in overall LGBT self-identification, the poll revealed. Young people identifying as LGBT increased from 5.8% in 2012 to 7.3% in 2016. Women in general were slightly more likely to identify as LGBT than men. Among ethnic identities, Asians demonstrated the largest increase in LGBT self-identification, followed by Hispanics. The proportion of LGBT Black Americans rose marginally, while non-Hispanic whites remain the least likely to identify as LGBT at 3.6%, but still up from 3.2% 5 years ago. In a span of only 5 years, the demographic composition of Americans who identify as LGBT has markedly changed, the report concluded. It has become larger, younger, and more female.
And finally, a CARE 2 online petition created by out actor and activist George Takei to oppose the increasing Islamophobia and persecution of Muslims in the U.S. has already drawn tens of thousands of signatures. As a gay man who spent part of his youth in a U.S. Japanese internment camp during World War II, Takei seems unusually qualified to warn about what continued attacks on minority Muslims could lead to under soon-to-be President Donald J. Trump. Takei wrote in his petition that Trump continues to stand by his plans to establish a Muslim registry and ban immigrants from certain Muslim countries from the U.S. It starts with a registry, with restrictions, with irrationally ascribed guilt, and with fear. But we know well where it might lead. National security must never again be permitted to justify wholesale denial of constitutional rights and protections. As of January 13th, more than 80,000 people had signed Takei's online petition.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 14th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
I'm Kate Clinton, and while I can joke about the political state of our country, it's no laughing matter what Congress could do to our civil rights.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
An informed community is a strong community.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America. There is not a Black America and a white America and Latino America and Asian America. There's the United States of America. The pundits like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states. Red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats. But I've got news for them, too. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states. And yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states. We are one people, all of us pledging allegiance to the Stars and Stripes, all of us defending the United States of America.
We're gonna keep on walking forward. Keep on walking forward. Keep on.
When most of the world first met Barack Hussein Obama at the 2004 Democratic National Convention, he seemed to promise a new political generation that would keep on moving forward for rights and equality. When he was elected to the presidency in 2008, the hopes of the LGBTQ community were raised even higher.
I am a fierce advocate for equality for gay and lesbian Americans. It is something that I have been consistent on and something that I intend to continue to be consistent on during my presidency.
However, the stone wall of congressional Republicans would block the forward movement for so long that activists nearly lost confidence in the would-be fierce advocate-in-chief, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term.
Obama did survive to be a two-term president, but his era of hope is now giving way to the uncertainties of Trump. The administration of the 44th U.S. president has racked up an impressive list of pro-LGBTQ accomplishments. At the annual Pride reception in June 2016, Obama recalled some of the highlights.
Welcome to the White House. This is the 8th Pride reception that we will celebrate together. I want to begin by saying thank you to all the people that I'm looking out in the audience. I see some new friends, but a lot of old friends, folks who have been with us through thick and thin. And I am grateful for all that you've done to work with us to accomplish some amazing transformations over these last 7.5 years. You know, every year we set aside this month to celebrate the ways that so many lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender Americans have helped to make our union just a little more perfect. We honor the countless nameless heroes who paved the way for progress, the activists who marched, the advocates who organized, the lawyers who argued cases, the families who stood by their loved ones, even when it was tough, every brave American who came out and spoke out, especially when it was tough. Because of them, because of all of you, there's a lot to be proud of today. Today, we live in an America where don't ask, don't tell, don't exist no more. There will never be a full accounting of the heroism demonstrated by gay Americans in service to this country. Their service has been obscured in history, been lost to prejudices that have waned in our own lifetimes. But at every crossroads in our past, we know gay Americans fought just as hard, gave just as much to protect this nation and the ideals for which it stands. We live in an America that protects all of us with a hate crimes law that bears the name of Matthew Shepard. Thanks to heroes like Edith Windsor and Jim Ober. I always get Jim's name. Jim knows I love him, but I never know where to put the emphasis. Obergefell. We now live in an America where all of our marriages and our families are recognized as equal under the law.
Is this Jim?
Yes, it is, Mr. President.
I just want to say congratulations.
Thank you so much, sir.
Your leadership on this, you know, is changing the country.
I really appreciate that, Mr. President. It's really been an honor for me to be involved in this fight and to have been able to, you know, fight for my marriage and live up to my commitments to my husband. So I appreciate everything you've done for the LGBT community, and it's really an honor to have become part of that fight.
I couldn't be prouder of you and your husband. God bless you.
Thank you, sir. That means an incredible amount to me.
You know, when you talk to the upcoming generation, our kids, Malia, Sasha's generation, they instinctively know people are people and families are families. And discrimination, it's so last century. It's so passé. It doesn't make sense to them. So we live in an America where the laws are finally catching up to the hearts of kids and what they instinctively understand. So some folks never imagined we'd come this far. Change can be slow, and I know that there have been times where at least some of the people in this room have yelled at me. But together, we've proven the change is possible, that progress is possible. It's not inevitable, though. History doesn't just travel forward. It can go backwards if we don't work hard. So we can't be complacent. Securing the gains this country has made requires perseverance and vigilance, and it requires voting.
No, no, no. Don't boo. Vote. Vote. Voting's the best revenge.
We have to work hard to make sure that jobs are not being denied, people aren't being fired because of their sexual orientation. We still have work to do when transgender persons are attacked, even killed, for just being who they are. I repeatedly called on Congress to pass the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. We have laws that say Americans can't be fired on the basis of the color of their skin
or their religion or because they have a disability. But every day, millions of Americans go to work worried that they could lose their job, not because of anything they've done. I know it's terrible, but because of who they are. It is wrong. The majority of Fortune 500 companies already have non-discrimination policies to protect their employees because it's the right thing to do and because many say it helps to retain and attract the best talent, and I agree. So if Congress won't act, I will. I have directed my staff to prepare an executive order for my signature that prohibits discrimination by federal contractors on the basis of sexual orientation and identity. And I've asked my staff to prepare a second executive order so that federal employees who are already protected on the basis of sexual orientation will now be formally protected from discrimination based on gender identity as well. We got work to do when LGBT people around the world still face incredible isolation and poverty and persecution and violence and even death. We have to work to make sure that every single child, no matter who they are or where they come from or what they look like or how they live, feels welcomed and valued and loved. You know, the great and often unsung civil rights hero, Bayard Rustin, once said, we need in every community a group of angelic troublemakers. I like that. And that's what I see here tonight. You know, people who aren't afraid to ruffle feathers in the name of justice and equality until we extend the full promise of America to every single one of us. And that's always been our story, not just in Selma or Seneca Falls, but in Compton's Cafe and the Stonewall Inn. It's the story of brave Americans who are willing to risk everything, not just their own liberty or dignity, but also doing it on behalf of the dignity and liberty of generations to come. You know, they understood a truth that lies at the heart of this nation. When all Americans are treated equal, we're all more free. And that's what should give us hope. You know, despite our differences and our divisions and the many complicated issues that we grapple with, real change is possible. Minds open, hearts change, America shifts. And if the past few years have taught us anything, it's that people who love their country can change it. You know, one of the most special moments of my presidency was that warm summer night last June when we lit up the White House. Yeah. You know, it was a powerful symbol here at home where more Americans finally felt accepted and whole and that their country recognized the love that they felt. It was a beacon for people around the world who are still fighting for those rights. It was a reminder that when the change we seek comes and when we move a little bit further on our journey toward equality and justice, we still have a responsibility to reach back and help pull up others who are striving to do the same. So enjoy tonight. Have some champagne. Some of you already have, I can tell. Tomorrow, we get back to work. And by the way, we get back to work not just fighting on behalf of justice and equality for the LGBT community, but for everybody. Because if you've felt the sting of discrimination, then you don't just fight to end discrimination for yourself. You got to fight for the poor kid who needs opportunity. You need to fight for the working mom who can't pay the bills. You got to fight for some young woman on the other side of the world who can't get an education. It can't just be about us. It's about we and what we can do together. So I'm very proud to have fought alongside you. We got more miles in the journey, and I'm so glad that we're going to be traveling that road together. Thank you very much, everybody.
Is this, in fact, your first interview in a bar?
It is my first interview in a bar.
That wasn't a pickup line, although MSNBC's well-known out lesbian anchor Rachel Maddow was meeting with Attorney General Loretta Lynch at the Stonewall Inn. President Obama, in June of 2016, made the bar that was the birthplace of the modern LGBTQ movement the first national monument dedicated to queer history. So it seems an appropriate place for an exit interview with the nation's top law enforcement officer.
During your tenure as Attorney General, you have gone out of your way to say your government is not against you. Law enforcement is not against you. I was struck in particular when your department sued North Carolina over their bathroom bill that went after trans people. You made this passionate statement. You said,
"Let me also speak directly to the transgender community itself. Know this, that the Department of Justice and indeed the entire Obama administration want you to know that we see you. We stand with you, and we will do everything we can to protect you going forward. And please know that history is on your side."
You saying that direct to camera, speaking to that community that has, I mean, the murder rates against trans
yes.
women, African-American trans women in particular, who are so important to the history of this place, it means a lot to hear the Department of Justice is on your side. It also feels like the Department of Justice may not necessarily still be on their side in the next administration. Do you feel like you can really say history's on your side, things are bending in your direction?
Well, I think that, look, obviously a lot of things change with the turn of the electoral wheel. But history is bigger than just the electoral wheel. Mm. History is bigger than any one administration or even any one attorney general. History encompasses all of the change and the progress that we've made. And history is on the side of marginalized people who speak up for themselves, of people who feel isolated and left out, who speak up for themselves. It doesn't mean that there won't be challenges. But I will tell you, Rachel, this work has always been hard. Mm. There have always been challenges to this work. There have been times when the structure of government has been even more opposed to different groups than it is now. We have had state-sanctioned discrimination in this country for years, and the civil rights movement itself was about breaking down those barriers, breaking down those laws, and giving us the Civil Rights Act of 64 and 65 and the Voting Rights Act.
But the movements came first.
But the movements came first, and the movements, Rachel, are composed of people. They're composed of people who are living their lives and who look up and say, this is not fair, this is not right. And when they come together, whether it's here at Stonewall, whether it was in Selma, that's when you see change. Change comes from up. It moves mm-hmm. up the ladder. And I think that people now, in all groups who deal with all issues, have been energized in a way that they will keep raising these issues to the new administration. And I think that it's going to be in a way that cannot be ignored.
Don't boo, vote! Vote! Voting's the best revenge.
We're going to work for change together. Work for change together.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Carol Myers and Christopher Gall contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Judy Spall performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CJAM Windsor, Ontario, WRFZ Rochester, New York, KCSB Santa Barbara, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The French Revolution made a deep impression, understandably, on all sorts of political thinkers, including Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. So when Marx and Engels wrote their Communist Manifesto, they were guided to a significant extent by what had transpired in France beginning in 1789. But what occurred in the revolutions that shook Europe in 1848 and 1849, just after the manifesto was published, was very different than how the French Revolution unfolded, and that led Marx and Engels to change and adapt their understanding. And it also led subsequent socialist thinkers to read and interpret the manifesto in different ways. Emanuele Saccarelli has written about some of the debates that arose around how a socialist revolution could or should be carried out, whether workers should first fight alongside the capitalist class against, you could say, the enemies of its enemies, or whether the working class should shun any alliance with the capitalist class or bourgeoisie. Emanuele Saccarelli is an associate professor of political science at San Diego State University and the author of Gramsci and Trotsky in the Shadow of Stalinism. He also contributed an essay entitled The Permanent Revolution in and Around the Manifesto to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto, edited by Terrell Carver and James Farr. When Emanuele Saccarelli joined me from a studio in San Diego, I first asked him to discuss the importance of the Communist Manifesto as an historical and a political document.
The manifesto is an immensely important political document, not so much at the time of its writing and publication. Although even then, it had a definite, let's say, prophetic quality that anticipated many of the things that actually happened and then continue to happen, as a matter of fact, down to today. But eventually, with the rise of Marxism as a movement, not simply as a series of ideas, as a political movement, the manifesto very quickly emerged as a very significant founding text for that particular tradition, due in large part to its remarkable intrinsic quality as a text. It's an incredibly moving work that has an energy and a power that is really rare to find. And I think it also speaks very powerfully to contemporary conditions as well.
The Communist Manifesto was published in February 1848. What prompted Marx and Engels to write it?
This is itself an interesting story because Marx and Engels are often sort of taken as part of the history of Western political thought, you know, from Plato to through various characters, and they're certainly part of that. But they also represent, let's say, a new type of intellectual, which is not Plato, and it's not Machiavelli or Locke. They were people who were very directly and militantly involved in political struggle in ways that the philosophers of the older period were not, typically, with some exceptions. And so what prompted them to write this text was a political series of events, and namely the appearance of an organization of workers called the Communist League, which formed. It used to be called the League of the Just, and in 1847 the Communist League came about, consisting largely of workers, and they required a political program and a series of conceptions of what it is that they would fight for. And enter Marx and Engels as, at some level, ordinary intellectuals who went through the usual circuits of university and dissertation, etc. But by this time, they had decisively cast their lot with ordinary working people, and then really oriented their own talents and skills and sacrifices and efforts to this new cause, which was represented by ordinary working people. So they were essentially commissioned to write this text to give principles and guidance to the Communist League.
Now, as you write in this essay in the Cambridge Companion, you write, the manifesto does two things. It offers a theory of historical development, of the unfolding of history, and it addresses how to act, how to take action politically. Elaborate on those two facets of the document.
This too somewhat corresponds to what I just discussed in terms of sort of it operates as a somewhat conventional big idea type of text in the history of Western political thought. So it has a very definite explanation of the historical process and politics and political struggle and the composition of society, the nature of the state, the increasingly international character of all of these processes and questions. In other words, it seeks to explain how the world and society in particular functions. And then side by side with that as a manifesto, it also very much encourages and sets itself up as a political intervention in the present. And therefore, it has definite programmatic demands. It is a manifesto in the ordinary sense of political parties today, which fight for definite things as opposed to other parties and rival programs and conceptions. So that kind of dual nature is itself very interesting. The programmatic demands are not purely pragmatic. It's not just they don't emerge arbitrarily. They emerge rather out of the explanation of how society functions and where history is headed. Or flipping that around, the theory of historical development is not purely contemplative or passive, but it identified very precisely a link in the chain of history at which actual human pressure can be exerted and political action can take place.
So there are so many things that could be said about the manifesto and have been said. You in this essay have chosen to focus on some debates around a concept, a term called the permanent revolution. And let's start with what Marx and Engels meant when they used the term.
This concept is a very significant political concept. When they originally used it, it wasn't really a concept so much as a historical allusion when they were talking in particular about the nature of the great French Revolution. And there they used this term of permanent revolution to refer to the fact that starting in 1789, the revolutionary process had a series of very interesting and sharp twists and turns. For a time, it kept going more and more to the left, and it began simply as a rejection of the monarchy, or at least a rejection of the latest demands on the part of the monarchy by the Third Estate, and then it developed more and more radically and in a revolutionary manner down to the Jacobins and their government in 1793, 1794. So this was permanent revolution attempted to capture this idea that within the same set of events, there were multiple revolutionary surges and dynamics. Then, after the actual historical experience of 1848-49, there were a series of revolutions throughout continental Europe. Marx and Engels began to really use the same term in a different way. Suddenly, it became an actual political concept. And what they meant generally was that although much of the world still required what they called a bourgeois democratic revolution, because the old hierarchies and state forms of old, the characteristic of feudalism and absolutism, were still around. And the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class, was supposed to go through this script of the great French Revolution and overthrow all those archaic political forms and replace them with modern, let's say, liberal and democratic forms, parliaments, constitutions, etc. Marx and Engels began to notice that the capitalist class became more and more hesitant, reluctant, and then actively hostile to that prospect. And therefore, that meant that even the basic bourgeois democratic rights of liberalism and constitutionalism, that began to fall more on the backs of the modern working class. That even though the working class was or should have been oriented towards socialism well beyond the somewhat narrow parameters of bourgeois democracy, the working class had to sort of be the protagonist for this entire process, from breaking down what was left of feudalism and absolutism through the experience of modern sort of bourgeois state all the way through socialism. So permanent revolution was a sort of compression of historical stages that before the experience of the mid-19th century were regarded as really distinct. First, a kind of a decades of bourgeois democracy, and then eventually the fight for socialism. Permanent revolution meant that that process would be combined and compressed.
His name is Emanuele Saccarelli. He is associate professor of political science at San Diego State University, and he contributed an essay entitled The Permanent Revolution in and Around the Manifesto to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto. It's published by Cambridge University Press. So you were talking about what Marx and Engels observed, what they noticed about what was happening in 1848, 1849, throughout Europe, all these revolutions and upheavals. What had they said in the Communist Manifesto about the degree to which the proletariat, the working class, would need to depend on the capitalist class, would need to work, in some senses, with the bourgeoisie in order to achieve their ultimate goals?
Yes, what they said in the manifesto was somewhat, let's say, provisional, and it had a political line, but I think it's also clear in reading the document that one would have to test it on the grounds of what would actually happen in the course of the revolutionary process. The general line seems to be that the working class basically for a time would have to fight not its enemy, the capitalist class, but the enemy of its enemy. That is to say, these remnants of feudalism, absolutism, monarchies, the aristocracy, all these archaic forces. And then and to fight against those side by side with the bourgeoisie, having vanquished those forces, then the real struggle for socialism could take place on a higher historical plane of bourgeois democracy, again, constitutions, liberalism, rights, etc. However, they also very clearly make the point that even though this class alliance would be necessary, there are certain important qualifications in the manifesto. One of them is that they insisted that we should fight with the capitalist class whenever it acts in a progressive and revolutionary manner, suggesting that when it doesn't, then we shouldn't go in that direction. So that was one important qualification to that.
Could you talk more, Emanuele, about how the bourgeoisies in Europe, how they conducted themselves during the revolution, the revolutions of 1848-49, such that Marx and Engels and many radical thinkers and revolutionaries lost faith in the bourgeoisie and its ability to provide a kind of spur to the eventual working class revolution?
Yes. As I said earlier, apparently the template was there. The bourgeoisie was simply meant to kind of carry out the same general script as had taken place in 1789 France. That is to say, a fight in a very revolutionary and principled manner against monarchy, and let's say what was left of feudalism, aristocracy, etc. What happened in 1848-49 throughout Europe was of a very different character. First of all, it was not the capitalist class that really initiated this wave of revolutionary movements. It was actually popular layers, workers, or what Marx called the petit bourgeoisie. Wealthy people were not initiating these revolutionary processes, and once they began, they very quickly took a somewhat equivocal position. Their basic political thinking went something like this. They would have much preferred to have bourgeois democracy over various forms of monarchical political rule. But they were also very concerned that, unlike in 1789 in France, by 1848-49, there was in fact a modern working class. The process of industrialization is typically dated to be complete around that time. There were large factories, and the modern proletariat existed. In the face of that reality, the bourgeoisie began to get cold feet when it came to these revolutionary struggles, because they simply could not be certain that they could control fully the revolutionary process. They could perhaps control where it began, but they had no assurances that they could control where it would end. And texts like the Communist Manifesto already, in a sense, put them on notice that if the feudal order and the monarchies were to fall, next on the agenda would be them. And so these people, of course, were not stupid. They understood that there was a countervailing factor now in the world of politics. Their revolutionary enthusiasm of 1789 was dampened by the presence of the working class. And Marx has other texts in which he brilliantly exposes their cowardly behavior, their hesitations, their timid orientation toward the monarchy, and ultimately really that they actually cut a political deal with the old order, preferring that to rolling the dice on a revolutionary process that, as I said earlier, may not end too well for them. And so all of these revolutionary events that swept the great cities of Europe, Rome, I'm from Rome, the Pope, fell and was replaced briefly by a republic, Vienna, Berlin, Paris, of course. All of these cities went through an actual revolutionary uprising in which the workers played a leading role, in which the bourgeoisie reluctantly participated and then pulled back. And the case of Paris is perhaps the most instructive case, because there's a revolution in February 1848, then there's a second revolution in June, and the bourgeoisie intervenes in that second revolution very directly to basically wipe out the workers from their barricades. So they literally are on the other side of the barricades. People like Alexis de Tocqueville, for example, who represented them, are fighting on the other side of the barricades, and they would eventually feel far more comfortable with an accommodation with the monarchy than with the processes they were witnessing throughout Europe.
Let's talk about one of the thinkers you focus on in your essay in the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto, and that is Karl Kautsky, a theoretician, a journalist, prominent radical thinker. I think he was Czech Austrian, born in 1854. What did he say about the prediction of Marx and Engels in the manifesto that there would be kind of a bourgeois revolution followed by a proletarian revolution?
This is, of course, a complicated story. To set it up, I suppose the first thing to note is that by the time Kautsky was writing, Marxism really had become a mass organized political movement. He was a member of the mass working class party, the Social Democracy of Germany. He was its leading intellectual. So in a certain sense, if the manifesto could issue a series of prophecies that would begin to come about later, by this time, let's say the turn of the century, 19th to the 20th, the political concreteness of communism was far more visible. And so Kautsky is writing as really a leader of the mass movement. His attitude toward the permanent revolution and what was in the manifesto was very interesting. Often Marxism is taken to be a sort of a dogma or series of religious beliefs that are simply to be memorized and preached. Kautsky has a different attitude, like all the actual Marxists of the time and perhaps down to today. He understood Marxism as a method to analyze the world as it existed, not as a fully finished, ready-made set of formulas. So one of the things he writes is something that poses a very impertinent question, is to what extent is the Communist Manifesto obsolete? Certainly doesn't give the sense of a kind of a religious dogma. He really wanted to think through 50 years of actual political and economic development in Germany as well as the world and test and verify the extent to which one could say that the manifesto was still accurate. Of course, the manifesto for him was plenty accurate in the broad strokes, you know, the class nature of the state, that he was not a neutral institution. It was a series of institutions controlled by a definite layer of society, a class. The general sequence of historical development, which we gestured toward earlier, he thought that was, of course, correct. The part that was to be reassessed was exactly the issue that a permanent revolution points to, which is to say, what can we expect out of the bourgeoisie in Germany or in other countries? For example, in Russia. And on that score, Kautsky expressed very substantial reservations that the old script of 1789 France could be simply replicated and reproduced. And this is, of course, because capitalism, particularly in countries like Germany and Russia, where it came late, the sequence of event meant that the bourgeoisie was of a somewhat different character. The French bourgeoisie had a heroic period and a suitably heroic series of great figures like Danton and Robespierre and Voltaire and Rousseau and people of that nature. The German bourgeoisie was a different animal, and certainly the Russian bourgeoisie was a different animal. The old hero, the heroes of the bourgeoisie were no longer visible, only very intellectually somewhat pitiful and politically very passive types represented the bourgeoisie. So Kautsky basically, not categorically, but begins to grope in the direction of this idea of permanent revolution, meaning that it's going to be up to the working class to even carry out the political objectives that are historically associated with the capitalist class. And then as it does that, what would happen is that this struggle would very quickly fold into a struggle for socialism. Kautsky is usually not associated with this idea because eventually he would become quite a conservative figure and play a somewhat different role later on, especially after the Russian Revolution. But it is part of this book titled Witness to the Permanent Revolution, edited by Richard Day and Daniel Guido, which I use in my work, which really shows that the permanent revolution had a broader, let's say, origin and application. Later on, it becomes associated, rightly, with Leon Trotsky, who was a very prominent figure in the Russian Revolution and an opponent of Stalinism. But there was a kind of an underbrush of important Marxist figures who were, although not as explicitly and directly in Finnish form as Trotsky, they were beginning to rethink some of these, rethink the template. And Kautsky was a very prominent version of that type of rethinking.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Emanuele Saccarelli joins me. He teaches political science at San Diego State. He's the author of Gramsci and Trotsky in the Shadow of Stalinism. And we are talking about an essay he wrote that he contributed to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto that's edited by Terrell Carver and James Farr. We have a link to Professor Saccarelli and to the Cambridge Companion on our website, againstthegrain.org. How concerned was Karl Kautsky that some readers of the manifesto would and did use the assertion in that document that the working class has to fight together with the bourgeoisie, that those readers, those interpreters of the manifesto would push a kind of reformist rather than a revolutionary agenda?
Yes, he was very concerned. He noticed a certain mood in the German SPD, a tendency.
Social Democratic Party?
Yes, of Germany. He noticed a mood of conservatism, a mood of accommodation with the status quo and certainly with the bourgeoisie. And he, for a time, fought against this. And his comments on the permanent revolution are exactly an expression of that, a fight against this conservative tendencies. This struggle against what would be known as revisionism took up a great deal of time and energy on the part of people like Kautsky, and also another famous participant in this was Rosa Luxemburg. And Kautsky was extremely worried about this turn of events. And therefore, he went back to the manifesto, among other texts, to sort of make this point. And it was not just a point about what's in the manifesto, but really it was a point about what is Marxism and to what extent can one simply rely on canonical texts as opposed to an analysis of the concrete situation on the ground to advance the cause of socialism. So in looking at Germany, but also in looking at Russia, he noticed, rightly, that capitalism had been around for decades and very modern industry had been installed, certainly in Germany, but also more and more in Russia as well, and yet the political superstructure in this country was not changing. Certainly Germany didn't have a proper liberal democracy. He had a very curious parliamentary system with a Kaiser on top of that. And of course Russia had a Tsar, the most archaic and really quite awful of all of these political forms. And so why was that the case? And Kautsky begins to think that the German and the Russian bourgeoisie may not have particular interest in overthrowing those types of institutions and establishing a proper bourgeois democracy. And he sees this very clearly in the actual political behavior of these people. If you think about Russia, I mean, an extremely wealthy capitalist in Russia would look at the Tsar and say, well, of course, I don't particularly enjoy the absence of freedom of the press and freedom of assembly. Perhaps that person would be at some level still inspired by the great slogans of the French Revolution. But the reality is that the Tsar is a very useful political instrument, because when the workers go on strike, and in Russia they would more and more and more militantly, the Tsar has some nice features, very attractive features, secret police to infiltrate the workers' movement, a massive body of armed men to crush them in the streets when that's necessary. And so from the standpoint of the bourgeoisie, these archaic forms are actually more and more regarded as not just a wart on the body politic, but more and more as a real necessity. And by the way, this is true to this day. I don't think these are just issues of historical significance. When one looks, for example, at countries like in the Middle East, like Egypt or Saudi Arabia, and one thinks about, well, those are definitely capitalist countries. And yet the political superstructure is quite archaic. Why is that? Well, it's because of the reasons that Kautsky began to formulate.
You mentioned Leon Trotsky, who, of course, got into a rather severe disagreement with Stalin with terrible consequences for his political career and his life. What did Trotsky mean by permanent revolution?
I just begin by noting simply that, of course, the fight between Trotsky and Stalin, yes, it had terrible consequences for Trotsky's career, but I'm tempted to say that it actually had terrible consequences for humanity at large, insofar as the banner of communism began to be associated with the behavior of the bureaucracy in the Soviet Union headed by Stalin. But Trotsky's role was really quite unique at this time in the international movement of Marxism. He was the one, as I suggested earlier, that was really the most... He pushed this notion of the permanent revolution down to its kind of most fully formed expression. Whereas people like Kautsky and others sort of were thinking about this, could not really come to a categorical conclusion about the fact that the period of a revolutionary and progressive bourgeoisie was over, Trotsky really, really boldly stated this. And this, of course, would have enormous implications for the actual historical development in places like Russia, as well as the world, really, because this was a matter of the highest political significance. The worker movement, according to Trotsky, could not play auxiliary role for a progressive bourgeoisie with an eye to establishing a bourgeois democracy, and then after that, take up the fight for socialism. The bourgeoisie was simply no longer a progressive force, and that lesson had to be digested. It was right. Already the lesson of 1848, 1849, and yet wide sections of the Marxist movement had not really come to grips with it. Trotsky was the one who stressed this most sharply and without equivocation.
So we have Kautsky, we have Trotsky, we have many others saying that, you know, to say that the proletariat would have to serve as kind of the left wing, the radical wing of the bourgeois revolution, no longer made sense. And it makes me wonder how some thinkers could think of the manifesto as, you know, being so predictive such that it had a kind of a dogmatic quality. In other words, wouldn't it be logical, like Kautsky asserted, wouldn't it be logical that Marx and Engels could not foresee even what would happen in 1848, 1849? I mean, it's not like they had a crystal ball and they could somehow lay out the future unfolding of the revolution or the lack thereof for eventual followers.
Yes, it would be logical, definitely. And actually, if someone were to simply follow Marx and Engels' views already by 1850, they're really on record. There's a text called the 1850 Address to the Central Committee of the Communist League, which actually ends with a call for the revolution in permanence. And the content of that text is basically to register the fact that the bourgeoisie betrayed us, that this class behaved in a reactionary manner in those revolutionary waves, and therefore it's time to draw those conclusions. That's the same, of course, the same conclusion in the famous 18th Brumaire of Napoleon Bonaparte, which is another brilliant text written by Marx. It's the same basic idea. So even a somewhat sort of literal follower of Marx would have had to kind of come to this conclusion. But, you know, as you rightly point out, the point of Marxism was not to hand you a series of ready-made formulas, but to provide a method to understand history and political reality. And so this was not well understood. Why? It wasn't simply a failure of the intellect. For example, this conservative mood that set in Germany had a definite material foundation. There were very large trade unions, which were actually built by the Marxist Party in Germany. And these unions, after a certain point, began to realize that a revolution might have been, as a matter of fact, bad business in certain sense, because it would have disrupted a steady growth of their own position that they began to enjoy quite a bit. I'm talking about the trade union bureaucracy in this particular instance. So there were, let's say, class pressures that came to bear on sections of the Marxist movement that pushed it, or sections of it, toward an accommodation with the bourgeoisie, toward a erasure of the lesson of 1848-49. And so, as I said, it wasn't simply an intellectual misstep, but there were real interests at stake in this as well. For example, Kautsky, in writing these things about the permanent revolution, he really attracted the hostility of the trade union bureaucracy within his own party, which hated this, which really thought that it was too soon to start talking about the proletarian revolution or even a revolution at all. There was a section of the SPD, particularly Bernstein, who began to think that, you know, we don't really need a revolution, that capitalism will more or less peacefully evolve into socialism, and we don't need to put our necks out to disrupt this steady evolution.
Emmanuel Saccarelli is my guest. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at San Diego State University. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Emmanuele about what he expresses and articulates in the chapter he contributed to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Emmanuele Saccarelli joins us. He teaches political science at San Diego State University. He's the author of Gramsci and Trotsky in the Shadow of Stalinism, and he is co-author with Lata Varadarajan of the volume Imperialism, Past and Present. And we are talking about an essay he contributed about the permanent revolution in and around the manifesto to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto. Another set of debates you address that you bring up in this article have to do with how capitalism would expand around the globe, and it certainly has, of course. What did the manifesto say about whether and how the capitalist system would expand beyond the places and nations in which it existed in 1847?
I think those are some of the most moving and, in a certain sense, correct passages of the manifesto. There are some really great striking phrases there. Their basic idea is a version of what today we could call globalization, that capitalism would not remain a insular mode of production, but would very systematically and very powerfully expand into every nook and cranny of the globe, which is, of course, precisely what happened. One of the striking phrases in the manifesto is that it would break down all Chinese walls, that any kind of national resistance, even on the part of very remarkable civilizations of a pre-capitalist character, would be systematically undermined. And if we look at China today, of course, in my view, one of the most important capitalist countries in the world, certainly crucial to the world capitalist economy, that's precisely what happened. Another interesting phrase in the manifesto is that, and this is very telling, perhaps of the limitations or problem with the general prognosis, is where they basically say that the bourgeoisie would create a world after its own image, which I take to mean that a version of this, that the original template of social and political transformation of England would be reproduced in all the countries of the world, which would also imply, of course, that the political history of England would be reproduced throughout all the countries of the world, meaning a parliament, and if not the abolition of the monarchy, certainly its substantial curtailing. And this is where I think the reality as it unfolded proved to be somewhat more complicated. Leon Trotsky, whom we talked about earlier, has this concept of uneven and combined development, which captures this. Certainly capitalism would expand and affect every country. There would be no oasis from the effects of capitalism. But the manner in which it would expand would be somewhat contradictory. It would bring with it the latest technology, technique, modern forms of production, and of course with that, a modern working class and a capitalist class, to be sure. But at the same time, it wouldn't necessarily reproduce the English template everywhere. I mentioned earlier Saudi Arabia, for example. Maybe it's too easy, but that's a very kind of classic case where I don't know anyone who would disagree with the notion that Saudi Arabia is thoroughly integrated in the world capitalist economy, and yet its political superstructure is definitely not England, although maybe today's England, that would be a little different. But it certainly is not a classic bourgeois democracy. It's as archaic as it gets. And capitalism expanded to the Middle East just fine without really disrupting these archaic political forms, and in some senses actually reinforcing them, and in other instances even reinventing them. So the capitalist class begins to use all kinds of traditional and archaic forms and forces as a prop, as a necessary prop, for some of the reasons we explained earlier, because they understood that there was a danger to their left, and the proper bourgeois democracy would expose them to a series of immense political danger. Imagine what it would be like to have, for example, freedom of the press or assembly in Saudi Arabia today. You know, there's an immensely exploited workforce, and this would mean that the profit extraction process would be very difficult. Or China. I mean, similar, although there are significant historical complications there, but what do we have? It's essentially a police state, which makes sure that the multi-million Chinese working class is exploited by multinational corporations. If you allow political liberties of a classical kind in China, this would be very much asking for trouble.
So in the essay, you point to a specific debate between two Russian thinkers, David Ryazanov and Georgi Plekhanov. And as I understand it, because we don't have time to get into a lot of the detail here, but Ryazanov thought that Plekhanov placed too much emphasis on general patterns of capitalist development being reproduced in Russia, and Ryazanov was like, no, there are these national peculiarities, as you alluded to, there are these characteristics specific to where we are, where Plekhanov and Ryazanov are, that affect how capitalism develops and proceeds. Why was Ryazanov so intent on pushing this point? What was he worried that Plekhanov would do, or perhaps did do, with this notion that, hey, capitalism will just kind of unfold in Russia similarly to how it's unfolded in other nations?
Yes, it's a similar story to what we discussed with Kautsky earlier. Essentially, Plekhanov, although historically played a very important role, he was regarded as the father of Russian Marxism. Plekhanov didn't exactly apply the method cogently to the reality in Russia in the sense that we just explained. The actual orientation of the bourgeoisie and the actual role of the working class in that country. And so he took up a more and more conservative position, which wanted the 1789 script from France to just play out in Russia, and expected that, which meant, of course, that the Russian bourgeoisie then was expected to be progressive. And then the corollary to that politically was that the Russian working class had to effectively subordinate itself to the political agenda of the bourgeoisie to jointly fight for a bourgeois democracy. Ryazanov fought against that. Again, by picking up on these elements, embryonic elements of permanent revolution from Marx and Engels, but more importantly from the actual unfolding of events on the ground. And these were, of course, very powerful discussions and very significant debates, because even though a neutral observer might have looked at a handful of intellectuals arguing over fine matters of theory at the turn of the 20th century, the reality is that out of those debates came the Russian Revolution of 1917. And so these are not arcane and remote considerations. This was a necessary theoretical preparation for a remarkable political earthquake, which really shook not just Russia, but the world.
We've put links on againstthegrain.org to my guests. That's Emanuele Saccarelli, his faculty page at San Diego State University, where he teaches political science, as well as to the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto. That's edited by Terrell Carver and James Farr. It's published by Cambridge University Press, to which my guest contributed a really interesting essay that we're focusing on today. Now, Emanuele, you've referred to kind of the continuing impact of these debates and these concepts in the sense of, you know, today's political and social environment. Can you talk more about the relevance of the debates that you bring up in this essay, in this chapter, to what's happening today, in addition perhaps to the bourgeoisie? And again, it's kind of a shorthand for the capitalist class, the capital accumulating class, in addition to what the capitalist class, the bourgeoisie, what status it holds, what agenda it has in contemporary capitalist society?
Yes, I think this issue of permanent revolution is absolutely critical to the future of the planet, really. Again, to sort of summarize very quickly what the concept is. The concept is that in countries in which capitalism developed late, a normal bourgeois parliamentary democracy is generally not in the cards. And it's not in the cards because of this political dynamic between the capitalist class and the presence of a modern working class. But then the flip side is also that in countries which have had capitalism for a while, one could say that really some of these normal bourgeois democratic institutions are now teetering on the brink of disaster. I mean, the American bourgeoisie, for example, its attitude toward the very state and constitution they themselves created, I think nowadays is of a very different character. They're not particularly committed to it. They're in the process of violating practically every item in the Bill of Rights. They control and oversee a government which routinely violates provisions in the Bill of Rights, including but not limited to state assassinations without due process and many other things of that nature. And so this is an immensely important question. There are also recent events. I mentioned Egypt earlier, but this is a very fresh test for the basic theory of permanent revolution, which states that, again, a normal bourgeois democracy will not come about. And if we look at Egypt today, after a series of convulsions and a great deal of hope, with the masses intervening in the streets and overthrowing the dictator Mubarak, what do we have today? We're back to a military dictatorship, which has the support of the American government. This is the ABC of the permanent revolution. And if that's the case, then I hope that listeners will realize that there are immense political stakes bound up with this concept, and they should take them very seriously. If I could, maybe another quick point to this, the issue of the working class. As I said earlier, the permanent revolution posited that even if the point was simply to defend or bring about bourgeois democracy, it would be the working class that would have to carry out this work. And I think that's also a very powerful political insight. When the Communist Manifesto was written, the working class was a tiny minority of the planet's population. Today, it is, alas, the majority of the world's population. Working people have really, in my view, little interest in war and exploitation. They're the victims of that. And so if one is looking for a natural, let's say, constituency for even just bourgeois democracy and its protections and freedoms, I don't think he would be the Bill Gates of the world. He would be ordinary working people.
Well, the working class can be concerned. It can be anxious. It can be worried. It can be precarious. It could be made more and more precarious. But where in the world do you see the kind of working class militancy that might feed a kind of revolution that would change things on a fundamental level?
Effectively everywhere. One could talk about China. The Chinese working class is extremely militant. It's difficult to get these reports, but they engage in very militant strikes routinely, and the Chinese Communist Party is very concerned about that. Egypt, which I just mentioned, I mean, the revolution was certainly not a handful of middle-class kids showing up at a square, but it came about on the heel of a series of very powerful strikes that by the working class in Egypt, which affected practically every sector of the industry. And then maybe finally, I think the American working class, which is often regarded with a certain measure of contempt by people on the left, is in fact objectively, I would say, absolutely a revolutionary class. The levels of social inequality that exist in this country are unprecedented. There are very definite signs after a long period of quiescence that the American working class is moving. One could think of the Verizon strike of late, for example. And I think that everywhere one looks, the working class is definitely moving to the left. In a certain sense, the Sanders phenomenon is an expression of that. If you look at France today, there are mass demonstrations practically every day and unmitigated hostility toward the bourgeois government of France and its state of emergency, which incidentally relates quite well to what I said earlier about the attitude of the bourgeoisie toward its standard ideals and practices. So I'm all of that to say that I think it's peculiar to me that this isn't part of a kind of understood common sense, that the working class is in fact moving and moving very powerfully to the left, and that they have every interest in effectively carrying out some of the things that Marx and Engels wrote about in the Communist Manifesto.
Well, I agree with you in part, but I mean, there's been a lot of talk about workers, you know, traditional left constituencies moving toward and cozying up with the sort of populist, nationalist, xenophobic, reactionary forces that have emerged. I mean, witness Trump. And I mean, there's an argument being made that, you know, the left and the right, it's kind of getting a little more ambiguous, and that there are a lot of people, working class people in the U.S., for example, who are backing candidates like Trump who are very, very far from the left, who are opposed to the left.
Yes, I mean, I take the point that the political landscape today is on its terms. It simply doesn't seem to, let's say, go in the direction I was talking about. I think that the official political establishment in the U.S. and elsewhere is absolutely corrupt and rotten. But I think to implicate the working class in it, I think I'm not prepared to do that. And I think the reason why is entirely bound up with what happened in Marxism, for one. And certainly one would have to unpack what exactly this left is. This is, of course, a complex question. But there used to be a time where working people in droves would join socialist and communist parties, including in the United States. What happened to that, in part, has to do not with the failure of the working class as a revolutionary class, but with the failure of a series of bankrupt political ideas, such as reformism or Stalinism, and the crimes, of course, committed in the name of the worker movement and Marxism. So to the extent that the working class peeled away from that, I don't think it's really their responsibility. Rather, it's the political history of the 20th century that would have to be unpacked very, very carefully to understand what happened to these ideas.
Emanuele Saccarelli, he is associate professor of political science at San Diego State University, co-author of Imperialism Past and Present, author of Gramsci and Trotsky in the Shadow of Stalinism. And you may also want to check out his essay in the Cambridge Companion to the Communist Manifesto. Thanks so much, Emanuele, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.